man's name was John Harmon.
Do you call it murder?
I do call it murder, sir.
Dickensian, Our Mutual Friend, starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Sunday afternoon at 3.
Good morning. It is 6 o'clock on Tuesday, the 29th of October. Good to have your company this morning. Good to be with you. This is Today with Michelle Hussein and Emma Barnett.
The headlines this morning: Israel's decision to ban the Palestinian refugee agency UNRWA has been widely condemned by allies, including the UK. Ahead of the budget, the government's announced new investment in the NHS, saying it will help to arrest the decline of the health service.
Also coming up in today's programme, buffer zones around abortion clinics, 150-metre zones where it will be illegal for anyone to influence, harass or provoke anyone entering, come into force later this week in England and Wales. So we went to see a protest in action. The daughter of MP Sir David Amess tells us the family have been left with no way of discovering the full background to his murder and feel abandoned.
Everybody was crying when he died and saying what a great man he was. Where are these people now helping to find out why he was let down? He is owed the decency and the respect to find out what went wrong.
And A Lost Waltz by Chopin has been found in a library in New York.
So when I saw this manuscript, I had a feeling of sort of cautious excitement. Perhaps, you know, if this is what I think it is, I might be one of the first people in modern times to hear this melody.
Amazing. And we can bring that to you today. The BBC News is read by Vijay Ellis.
Israel's allies have condemned a decision by the Israeli parliament to ban the UN's Palestinian Refugee Agency from working within the country, warning that it plays a critical role in delivering humanitarian assistance to Gaza. Israel has accused UNRWA staff of involvement in the 7th of October attacks and diverting aid in Gaza. Sir Keir Starmer said he was gravely concerned about the ban. Our Middle East correspondent Yolan Nell reports from Jerusalem.
Despite widespread international opposition, Israeli MPs voted overwhelmingly to approve two bills. These essentially bar UNRWA from operating in Israel and annexed East Jerusalem and severely curtail its ability to work in the occupied West Bank and Gaza, where it's the largest UN agency playing a vital role in distributing aid and running wartime shelters. The UNRWA spokeswoman, Julia Tuma, says the legislation breaches the UN Charter and Israel's obligations under international law.
The vote by the Israeli parliament is unprecedented. It's a threat to our common humanity. It's time to allow us to do our work. Just allow us to do our work. Enough. Enough.
Israeli officials accuse UNRWA of being complicit with Hamas and cite the involvement of a handful of its thousands of staff in the 7th of October attacks. The agency insists it's impartial. Responding to the new laws, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres insisted that UNRWA is indispensable.
Lebanon's health ministry says 60 people, including two children, have been killed in Israeli strikes on the Bekaa Valley. The local governor called the attacks the most violent in the area since Israel escalated the conflict against Hezbollah last month. The government has announced some details of its plan to fix what it's calling 14 years of damage done to the NHS by the Conservatives, including £1.5 billion of investment in equipment and buildings. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, said the move would help to arrest the decline in the health service, but warned there could still be patients waiting on trolleys and in corridors this winter. The Conservatives say they delivered record funding for the NHS. Here's our health editor, Hugh Pym.
For the first time, the government has set out some of its detailed thinking on how to reduce England's waiting list of 7.64 million. The Treasury says £1.8 billion of extra money has been provided to the NHS since the election for more operations and appointments. There'll be £1.57 billion allocated next year for equipment including scanners and radiotherapy machines. The extra money announced by Westminster will also lead to increased budgets in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. These are some but not all of the government's plans for the NHS. The budget will reveal the overall spending numbers and how these compare with the trend in previous years. The Health Foundation think tank welcomed the funding on equipment but said there were unanswered questions, including investment in staff and how the NHS would use technology.
Super-strength synthetic opioid drugs, which have been linked to hundreds of deaths, have been found in samples of fake medicines in the UK. The opioids, called nitazenes, can be stronger than heroin, and even a tiny amount can lead to a fatal overdose. Our correspondent Navthej Johal reports.
It's believed nitazenes are being made in illicit labs in China and are arriving in the UK by post. BBC analysis of data from the National Drug Testing Service, WEDINOS, shows they were detected 130 times in the 12 months to September in contaminated medicines sent to them. The UN Office on Drugs and Crime says this mirrors the start of the opioid crisis in the US, which was driven by prescription medicines. 15 synthetic opioids were banned in the UK in March. Last month, the government proposed legislation to ban more. But experts want more drug testing.
The daughter of the MP, Sir David Amess, who was murdered in his Southend constituency 3 years ago, has told the BBC she wants a full inquest into his death. Sir David was stabbed more than 20 times by Ali Harbi Ali, who had previously been referred to the Anti-Extremism Prevent Programme. Katie Amess said the authorities had let her father down. Our UK correspondent Daniel Sanford reports.
Ali Harbi Ali was convicted of murdering Sir David Amess in April 2022. Inspired by the Islamic State group, he stabbed the MP at his Friday morning constituency surgery at a church in Southend. The senior Essex coroner, Lincoln Brooks, decided, given there'd been a trial, an inquest wasn't needed. Sir David's daughter, the actress Katie Amess, wants an inquest to help investigate how Ali Harbi Ali was able to kill her father, despite being referred to the Anti-Extremism Prevent System by his school 5 years earlier. She's also concerned that her brother had called the police the night before the murder, saying he'd received threats to harm him and his father, and yet no police officer was at the surgery the next day. But the coroner concluded that the threats were taken seriously by the police and were wholly unconnected to the murder.
Kamala Harris and Donald Trump have been appealing to voters in key swing states as campaigning for the US election enters its final week. Ms. Harris told workers at a factory in Michigan that her Republican rival was only interested in tax cuts for big corporations. In Georgia, Mr. Trump hit back at critics who'd labeled him authoritarian, insisting he wasn't a Nazi. A 26-year-old man has died while in detention at Brookhouse Immigration Removal Centre near Gatwick Airport. The centre is managed by the contractor Serco, which confirmed the man had died on Sunday. The Home Office has said its condolences are with his family. Archaeologists have discovered a huge ancient city hidden underground in southeast Mexico. The city, which researchers have named Valeriana, had nearly 7,000 structures, including temple pyramids, plazas, houses, causeways, and reservoirs. It's thought it may have been home to up to 50,000 people in the 9th century.
Thanks, Fiji. It is 7 minutes past six, and it is time to get the latest on the weather from Sarah Keith Lucas at the BBC Weather Centre. Good morning, Sarah. What have you got for us?
Good morning, Emma. We've got another fairly cloudy day out there. There's a little bit of patchy light rain and drizzle in places, but there'll also be some sunshine developing through the day. So a really quiet spell of weather at the moment. We've got high pressure sticking around all week. The weather really not changing very much day to day at the moment. But I'll try to put some detail on it, and we'll start across all of southern England, Wales, the Midlands, Eastern England and Northwest England too. Well, to start this morning, we've got some drizzly rain around for parts of Northwest England, Wales, Southeast England as well. It is light and patchy and it'll tend to ease away through the day, but there'll be the odd spot lingering into the afternoon. Moving across parts of the Midlands, perhaps East Anglia could see a spot of drizzle or two as well. But there should be some brighter spells developing a little bit later on into the afternoon, particularly for Southern England and Wales, western parts of England too. Top temperatures here between about 15 to 17, so still a few degrees above average. Light winds around and some misty patches too. For northeast England and eastern Scotland, morning mist should clear away, and actually we're looking at some sunny spells developing. It will be across this region that we'll have the lion's share of the sunny spells today. Still some areas of cloud drifting around. It is looking dry and mild, 15 or 16 degrees. For Northern Ireland, southwest Scotland and northern Scotland, a fairly grey, cloudy sort of day ahead, but remaining predominantly dry. Some sunny spells for Northern Ireland and also for the far north of Scotland. Should be some sunshine for Shetland, for instance. Temperatures between about 12 to 14 degrees. Another dry night to come tonight with again some mist and some fog, and a similar outlook for the next few days.
Sarah, thank you very much. It is 9 minutes past six. Let's have a look at the papers. And budget plans for the NHS get widespread scrutiny. The Daily Mirror declares there's hope for the health service, calls the budget Labour's war on waiting lists. It says the Chancellor will pump billions of pounds into the health service tomorrow to save it from disaster. The Guardian says an injection of funds by Rachel Reeves will revive a broken but not beaten NHS and would end the neglect of the service under the Conservatives. The paper suggests the funding boost could be as much as £7 billion.
Other papers strike a note of caution. The Daily Telegraph says the Chancellor has signalled the amount earmarked for the health service will not be enough to fix it, and further tax rises may be needed in the years to come. The Times and the Daily Mail both highlight an acknowledgement from the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, who we'll be hearing from later in the programme, that the budget is unlikely to deliver major improvements or, as the Mail adds, prevent patients dying while waiting for care this winter.
The Eye carries a warning from charities that the confirmed plans to increase national insurance on employers will force them to make cutbacks, diverting funds from essential services. It says volunteer organisations have written to the Chancellor asking to be made exempt from the extra tax. The Daily Express continues its campaign to restore winter fuel payments to all pensioners with a front page message to the Chancellor: it's not too late for a U-turn.
The Financial Times says that the German carmaker Volkswagen is set for a battle with unions after plans to shut at least three factories, with thousands of job losses and a 10% cut in pay for others. It would be the company's first closure of domestic plants in its 87-year history. The FT says that the company will clash with powerful unions and politicians in Germany, where VW has 300,000 employees. Managers say the measures are needed in the face of intense competition from China and poor sales of electric vehicles.
There's a warning from the Children's Commissioner that social media companies are ignoring the harm they inflict on children while making billions of pounds from them. That's on the Telegraph's front page. A report based on children's experiences reportedly found examples of cyberbullying, sexual grooming by adult predators, and guides on self-harming. Dame Rachel D'Souza criticises the government and the regulator Ofcom for going too slowly in introducing safeguarding laws to tackle the multiple hazards in the online world. An Ofcom spokesman tells the paper they are bound by law to consult on codes to protect children, and though that took time, it resulted in better and more legally robust regulation.
And The Sun has a picture of the sacked Man U manager Erik ten Hag on his front page. It reports that the Dutchman, who they called Erik ten Swag, has been given a £15 million payoff. The Daily Star adds that the ex-United boss, very recently ex, was on a private plane within hours of his dismissal from the club, so it goes with the headline, "Jet me out of it."
12 minutes past six. US Election Day now a week away, and at his latest rally, Donald Trump has said he's not a Nazi. That comes after his former chief of staff told the New York Times that he heard Mr. Trump say Hitler did some good things too. Peter Bowes, our North America correspondent, joins us. So what exactly did Mr. Trump say last night, Peter?
Well, these are some of the most direct comments that we've heard from him on this subject. He said, "I'm not a Nazi. I'm the opposite of a Nazi." And then he added this, and again, quoting Donald Trump, he said, "The newest line from Kamala and her campaign is that anyone who isn't voting for her is a Nazi." Now, that is a line that Kamala Harris has not actually said. But it is interesting that here we are a week away from the election now, Republican candidate saying very openly, "I am not a Nazi." And as you said, in response to those comments by the retired four-star general, John Kelly, his former chief of staff, saying that, and he'd spoken to the New York Times, he'd also spoken to the Atlantic, substantiating a quote that Donald Trump had allegedly once said, "I need the kind of generals that Hitler had," that he had admired Hitler's generals.
Did Mr. Trump say anything about the row over comments at a previous rally, which were not his words, but the words of another speaker at the rally in New York, talking about Puerto Rico as a floating island of garbage?
No, he hasn't. He's been completely silent about that. And he is now under pressure from the Archbishop of Puerto Rico, who has called on Mr. Trump to personally apologise, to disavow those comments, the comments that were heard and were widely condemned by members of both parties, but heard on Sunday at that huge rally. The comment was that Puerto Rico was a floating island of garbage, and many in the Donald Trump campaign said that those comments did not reflect the views of the former president. But now the Archbishop of Puerto Rico saying that he would like to hear directly from Mr. Trump apologising for those words of that comedian.
Peter Bowes, thank you.
14 minutes past six. The BBC can reveal new super-strength synthetic opioid drugs linked to hundreds of deaths have been found in samples of fake medicines that are sold online to those trying to treat anxiety with allergies or sleeping problems. Navtej Johal is a BBC reporter on this story. What do we know? What can we say?
Well, we've been reporting on the rise of nitazines for more than a year now. These are drugs which can be hundreds of times more potent than heroin. It's believed they're being made in illicit labs in China and coming into the UK in the post. They're cheap to make, hard to detect, and most of the overdoses from them here have been linked to heroin use. There have been nearly 300 nitazine-related deaths in the past year. But what we've found now is that nitazines have been discovered in illicit fake prescription medicines too. Our analysis of data from the National Drug Testing Service, WEDNOS, which is run by Public Health Wales, has uncovered 130 times in the 12 months to September when nitazines were found in contaminated medicines people had tried to buy online in the UK to treat things like allergies, anxiety or insomnia. Now, the reason why that's such a big concern is that it means nitazines could now be affecting a new, unsuspecting group of people who don't often have the tolerance to opioids, they aren't known to drug charities, and are potentially less able to survive an overdose. And we presented our findings to the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, and they said this was a worrying development that mirrors the start of the opioid crisis in the United States in terms of drawing in people who are seeking prescription medicines.
And those people are going online to buy these medicines because they can't get them through their doctor, or what's the action there? Because as you say, that's regular people just going online and trying to find drugs, but then we're finding that these drugs have these traces of this very powerful drug inside them.
Well, the United Nations told us that some of these people may not be aware that they're actually buying illicit online pharmacies. Some of them may be aware of that, but they are not able to get that medication from a doctor, or it may only be available via a private prescription. So some of these people may also be trying to simply self-medicate. And that has been the case in one of the case studies we've spoken to, one of a family whose son died from an overdose last summer, who they believe was trying to self-medicate, was having sleeping problems, and sought out what he thought was medication to treat anxiety. Now, in terms of what's being done about this, there are 15 synthetic opioids which were banned in the UK in March, and last month the government proposed legislation to ban more. But experts are calling for urgent action, including more testing of drugs around the country. But the UN wants to see better communication between services and drug users, and they told us, though, that it's not likely that nitazines will just disappear. They've been detected in 29 countries already, and there are new types of nitazines emerging regularly. In fact, they're not aware of any other country in Europe which has seen as many nitazine-related deaths in the past year as the UK, although some of that will be down to more testing here. So efforts may have to be focused instead on their containment, they say.
Well, we will come back to this story a bit later, and that particular experience, that very sad experience that you refer to, we will hear some of your interview as well to bring that home to people. Navtej Johal, thank you.
It is now 18 minutes past six. Could the budget include an increase in the minimum wage as well as employers paying greater national insurance contributions? That's part of Sean Farrington's business news this morning. Morning, Sean.
Morning, Michelle. Yeah, another cost that has a very direct impact on the immediate running of the business. That Jamaican patty business I was at yesterday immediately saw half of its income go out in wages. So reports this morning of minimum wage rises being higher than predicted may mean businesses adjusting their budgets once again. I've got Nick McKenzie with me, who's chief executive of Green King, one of the UK's biggest pub chains, employing 40,000 people across the country. Nick, good morning to you.
Good morning.
This, if it came in at, say, 6%, as the Times is reporting this morning, increasing the minimum wage, would that be in line with your plans, given predictions before?
Yeah, look, I think it's slightly higher than we were envisaging, and is one of the costs that obviously has been trailed quite significantly over the last few weeks about what's coming through in the budget. I think this budget is an opportunity for the government to support the pub and brewing sector that supports 1 million jobs and gives £13 billion of tax revenue to the Exchequer. So we're hoping and we're looking forward to seeing what is in the budget. But obviously there is some cost increases that are coming through, whether that's national insurance or increases around national living and wage that are hitting our industry and hitting our businesses and potentially having an effect on our ability to invest in growth in the long term. So very interested to see the numbers that come through tomorrow.
Yeah, have you started making plans for those increased costs?
Yeah, look, we've been working on that for some time. Our costs have increased significantly since pre-COVID, since 2019.
About these latest cost increases that look set to be coming your way. So whether it's national insurance contributions for employers or minimum wage increases. I just wonder, just even in the last couple of months, what tweaks you make to your business or even bigger plans because of those changes.
Yeah, we have been looking at that and have been planning for that. We invest over £150 million a year in our business. The sector invests £2 billion across pubs and brewing. And obviously you look at that and consider how much money you've got to invest. And I think the opportunity the government has here is to support the industry to invest and to grow and to support their manifesto pledges to help the industry grow, create jobs and create opportunities for communities all around the UK. And our pubs are in all of our communities and important to those local communities. So, yes, we are looking at that. We don't want to see costs rise cumulatively. The cost of other things like packaging reform and extended producer responsibility, lots of other things hitting us. And it's really important for us that we get support, particularly around business rates and around freezing duty on beer. And we hope some of that will come through during the course of the budget.
Are you expecting some of that to come through? Is there confidence that you have that there will be a reform in business rates that will change your outgoings, that there will be a freezing of alcohol duty?
Look, we're hopeful. I mean, the government are clearly in a bit of a tricky position here, and they do need to fix the public finances. We understand that. But our industry is really important to communities around the country, and we really hope that the 75% relief to small businesses is maintained. We've talked about that to government over the last few months. The cliff edge of that could be really damaging to pubs. About £12,000 per pub, actually, the impact of that relief, and the same on duty. So the cumulative effect of all these rises is the critical thing to our industry. It could cost us £750 million if you add all that together. And the business rates reform that we need in the medium to long term is critical to maintaining some balance.
What about your customers, Nick? Just literally from what you've seen them spend and how they spend in recent weeks, is their mood changing?
Look, I think we're constantly looking at how customers and consumers are feeling. I think the last few months certainly has been a bit subdued in trading. The weather hasn't helped that, but certainly I think consumers are being very careful about what they spend and when they come out, and that does have an impact. So we're hopeful that the budget will, you know, allow people to have some certainty, allow business to have some certainty, and then obviously going into a very, very important trading period for the industry as we go into Christmas, hoping customers are going to come out and enjoy themselves in a.
Does that, if you want that certainty and you want your customers to have that certainty, does it make sense to you that if you're going to be increasing national insurance contributions, that actually it is on the employer? And in terms of an immediate change to the pay slips, as the Labour government is putting it, that many of your customers won't see that?
I mean, you know, look, anything that can go back into the pockets of people and then they will come out and spend is a positive, obviously. The cost of business is significant, though. So the rise in national insurance, the rise in national living wage is a big impact on our industry. And as I said, £750 million when you total all that up across the sector means that, you know, businesses like ours are looking at future investment. They're looking their teams and the size of their teams and thinking about what the future looks like.
So you're saying it could be job cuts, could be lower investment if the other help doesn't come?
I think that's the natural effect of this, that if you keep pushing cost into business, then that is going to happen. And, you know, what we hope is that the government will look at business rates as the main area that they can help in the short term and the medium term to help balance some of these issues up.
Nick, thank you. Nick McKenzie, their chief executive of Green King. Russ Mould, investment director at AJ Bell. Very good morning to you,
good
Russ.
Good morning to you, Sean.
Can I get a daily update on the debt markets, the cost of government borrowing effectively as we get ever closer to the budget? What's happening?
Yeah, the UK 10-year gilt, the benchmark sort of borrowing cost for the government, has has crept up to 4.26%. Now, when the Bank of England cut interest rates in August, that was at 3.92%. So normally you'd expect the gilt yield to come down to reflect the Bank of England base rate, but it hasn't. It's crept up. This may be a reflection of, you know, markets looking at what Chancellor Reeves has got to say on Wednesday, though I should also say that American headline borrowing costs have crept up at the same time as their election gets closer, because neither candidate there is making a particularly great fist of tackling the issue of the American deficit either.
So could it be, you know, we often try and compare these things globally as well, could it be that specific issues in the, here in the UK are pushing up those borrowing costs, and specific issues in the United States are pushing up borrowing costs there, and it's not necessarily the same global issue?
It's possibly six or one half dozen of the other. I think there is a gathering sense in some government bond markets that there is a fiscal problem out there and a deficit problem out there. I think the UK government is actually being pretty honest about the fact, about the scale of the challenge. I'm not sure either American candidates necessarily grasp it yet. In fact, both candidates' policies seem to be, you know, if anything, going to increase the deficit beyond what the US government is already forecasting.
Oil price, Russ, again, one that has been a bit more closely watched in recent months as the tensions in the Middle East sort of escalate. What's occurring?
I mean, the oil price is down by around a fifth over the past year. You've had the International Energy Agency in the past few days say that global supply is ample. The OPEC has actually cut its demand growth forecast for the next couple of years. And although we still have, you know, very high levels of tension in the Middle East, the Israeli retaliation over the weekend did not target Iranian oil supply facilities. So that means that the oil price in the last couple of weeks, the last couple of days, has come back. But over the past year, it's been soft because, at the moment at least, supply seems pretty plentiful and demand is okay, but not accelerating massively, perhaps hampered slightly by ongoing weakness in China. And over the long run, I guess we'll just have to see. At the moment, demand growth is still there. It's just not as strong as we've seen, or as OPEC was expecting, perhaps.
And what's your one-line take on the HSBC performance that we found out about earlier this morning?
Shares are up 2% on the Hong Kong exchange as we speak right now, Sean, to a near six-year high. So they're clearly going down very well, particularly because more cash returns in the form of dividends and share buybacks.
Russ, thanks so much. Russ Mould from AJ Bell, as we're hearing in the paper headlines this morning. Volkswagen planning to close those three plants, laying off thousands of workers, cutting pay by 10%, according to trade unions. Beatrix Keim is director of Centre Automotive Research in Duisburg, previously worked for the manufacturers, including Jaguar Land Rover, BMW and Volkswagen. And Beatrix, good morning to you. How drastic a move is this by Volkswagen?
Good morning, Sean. Thank you for having me. Well, it is in the light of history, it is a very drastic move. But in the light of business, it is a very necessary move, and it's high time to do so.
So what are going to be the ripple effects of this, if there aren't any already, across the European car manufacturing market and the market that many people will be looking to go into to buy their next car?
Well, there are different ripple effects. On one hand side, of course, on the German economy, if you look into that roughly 20% of our GDP are coming out of the automotive industry, of course, not Volkswagen alone, but all of the manufacturers and the suppliers. This is, of course, a very high impact. If people are getting laid off, then they are adding to the unemployment market and not spending money. So this is, on one hand side, the overall economy will be impacted. Overall, on the automotive side, Stellantis is actually really fighting the numbers as well. All over Europe, you can see that the e-mobility is not taking up as much as it was predicted, which is pretty much coming to uncertainties on the people side, that they are not really sure what is happening. On one side, on prices, cars are too expensive. Are the cars from China becoming more expensive with the tariffs, which are probably imposed by the EU? What is happening all over there with loading infrastructure and so on? And of course, what the colleague just before said, that China is not actually on the growth path as it was in the recent years,
So crucial for VW. Just finally, briefly, Beatrix, I wonder how is Germany reacting to major changes in one of its most traditional established sectors?
quite shocked because people didn't see it coming. Within the industry, it was quite clear that something will be happening as sales of 500,000 cars for Volkswagen alone are fading out. So I think everybody is shocked, as once again, the automotive industry is one of the major drivers of German economy. And that, of course, would have impact on anything where Germany is paying into the economy of the EU.
Beatrix, thank you. Beatrix Keim, Director of the Centre of Automotive Research.
Sean, thank you for that. You're going to have a busy 24 hours coming onto the budget. It's good to see you in the studio. But also in the studio is Carthy here at 29 minutes past six with the sport. Morning, Carthy.
Good morning. Thank you very much. The name in the frame to become the new manager at Manchester United is Portugal's Ruben Amorim. The 39-year-old led Sporting to their first Portuguese league title in 19 years when he joined them in 2020, and they've become champions for a second time since then under Amorim. Manchester United are looking for a replacement for Erik ten Hag, who was sacked yesterday. The BBC's football correspondent John Murray explains the background.
There'd been frenzied speculation towards the end of last season that Ten Hag would be sacked then. United had ended eighth, their lowest league finish for 34 years. But their winning of the FA Cup against Manchester City saw Ten Hag add that to the League Cup he won in his first season, and his contract was extended to 2026. Now, though, just 14 matches into the season, and with no end to the disappointing results and performances, Ten Hag leaves, and coach Ruud van Nistelrooy steps up while Manchester United search for a permanent replacement.
Wales women must win the second leg of their Euro 2025 playoff semi-final against Slovakia tonight to keep their hopes of reaching the tournament alive. Their manager, Rhian Wilkinson, knows what her team now has to do.
No room for error, and that's the position we've put ourselves in, but also coming home, great work in the last few days, getting back on the pitch, stripping it right back, and it's just about showing up for this team. They're an incredible group of players, and backs against the wall. We've got to deliver.
Scotland women have a 1-0 advantage when they host Hungary later. Northern Ireland drew 1-1 in their first leg with Croatia. The Republic of Ireland have a 6-0 advantage against Georgia. And England women have a friendly match against South Africa tonight. The Manchester City and Spain midfielder Rodri has won the men's Ballon d'Or, awarded to the best footballer of the year. The England and Real Madrid midfielder Jude Bellingham was in third place, while the Spain and Barcelona midfielder Aitana Bonmatí won the women's Ballon d'Or. And the former Chelsea women's coach, now head coach of the United States team, Emma Hayes, won the award given to the best women's coach in the game. Harry Kane and Kylian Mbappe took the trophy for scoring the most goals in Europe. And in rugby union, the England flanker Tom Curry says his body is now head and shoulders better than it was during the summer tour. Curry is back from a hip injury ahead of England's opening autumn international, which is against New Zealand this Saturday.
Carthy, thank you very much.
Unspeakable is the show where new words are born.
The word is ap nauseam, that sense of utter sickness when yet again you're inexplicably asked to download an app to do almost anything.
It's also the show in which annoying words are banished.
This needs no explanation.
Holy bobs.
And where lesser known words are brought out of hiding.
A seesaw. In Durham, it's best known as a shigshog.
Unspeakable, with me, Phil Wang.
And me, Susie Dent.
The shigshog just sounds like you're drunk in the playground. I'm just going to have a go on the shigshog.
This Thursday night's 6:30 comedy on BBC Sounds and Radio 4.
I'm looking forward to that. The time is 28 minutes to 7. You are listening to Today. Good to be with you. Good to have your company on BBC Radio 4 with Michelle Hussein and Emma Barnett. And now a summary of the news from Vigianis.
The United Nations Secretary General has said that a new law in Israel banning the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees from operating in the country will have devastating consequences. Israel has accused some staff from UNRWA of being involved in the 7th of October attacks. Antonio Guterres said there was no alternative to the organization, which provides aid in Gaza. The UK and the US have condemned the move. Lebanon's health ministry says 60 people have been killed in Israeli attacks on the eastern Bekaa Valley. The local governor described the attacks as the most violent in the area since the conflict with Hezbollah escalated last month. The Israeli military has not yet commented. The government has unveiled some details on how it plans to reduce NHS waiting lists in England following what it called 14 years of damage done by the Conservatives. Tomorrow's budget will include more than £1.5 billion for new surgical hubs and radiotherapy machines. The Conservatives say they provided record funding for the NHS. Super-strength synthetic opioid drugs have been found in samples of fake medicines being sold in the UK. They were sold online, purporting to treat conditions such as anxiety and insomnia. The opioids, called nitazenes, can cause death even in tiny quantities. A 26-year-old man has died while in detention at Brookhouse Immigration Removal Centre near Gatwick Airport. The centre is managed by the contractor Serco, which confirmed the man had died on Sunday. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump have been appealing to voters in key swing states as campaigning for the U.S. election enters its final week. Ms. Harris told workers at a factory in Michigan that her Republican rival was only interested in tax cuts for big corporations. In Georgia, Mr. Trump hit back at critics who'd labeled him authoritarian, insisting he wasn't a Nazi. A group of archaeologists has discovered a huge ancient city buried underground in southeast Mexico. They found the Mayan city by using archaeology tools to study radar images of the area, which revealed pyramids, sports fields and amphitheatres.
We'll be talking more about that discovery under the ground in an hour's time. Vijay, thank you very much. It is 25 to 7 and with the budget a day away, some details of the spending to be allocated to health are being revealed this morning. Hugh Pym, our health editor, joins us now. So what is the announcement today, Hugh, and how far does it go towards reducing waiting lists, which is the government's aim?
Well, Michelle, the government has given a few details, more than we've had before, on how it intends to meet its key NHS new target, which is 40,000 more appointments and procedures per week by the end of its first year in office, in other words, by next July. And the announcement has revealed that £1.8 billion was put into the NHS in England soon after the election to try to get more operations and procedures done. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has said more will be needed to meet the target. The other key bit of spending announced today is £1.5 billion for capital equipment, scanners and radiotherapy machines and so on, although that won't be till next year, in other words, from next April. So that's not going to help hit this target until the final 3 months of that year to July. What we don't have, though, is the overall spending numbers for this financial year for the Department of Health covering England and for next year. And only when we get those in the budget will we know how the increase in spending for the NHS, which the government have flagged up, how that compares with the previous trend. Is it more or less average? Is it a bit less or a bit more? So we've got a little bit of information and obviously this concession from the Chancellor and Wes Street in the Health Secretary that it may only arrest the decline of the last 14 years and there may well be problems this winter.
Yeah, he'll be with us at 10 past eight this morning. Given that the annual budget of the NHS in England is, what, around £180 billion?
Yes, indeed.
What's the kind of amount that would demonstrate that Labour is funding the NHS better than the last government?
Well, I think the key thing is to look at the real terms increase that is announced for the rest of this financial year to add to the total. And the NHS leadership in England has been pressing for more money to get through this winter. And the real terms increase for the next financial year, is it around 3%? If it is, that will look quite generous to some, but it would only be in line with the long-term historic average for NHS spending. Is it a bit more or is it a bit less? So I think we need the full spending envelope to work out how much difference this will make and how it compares with previous administrations.
Hugh, thanks very much.
Well, let's turn now to Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent. Henry, we were speaking yesterday as ahead of Keir Starmer making that speech to prepare the ground for the budget, which is coming out tomorrow. And just picking up on the politics of what we were hearing about the NHS and whether these tax rises will be enough. It's also a line being reported in some of the papers today from that speech that tax rises in the budget will pretty much be our last, says the Prime Minister yesterday. Where are we with that? And I suppose, what's the mood like with how this is being received ahead of the budget?
Well, one thing that I think ties today's health announcement to Keir Starmer's speech yesterday beyond the budget is the fact that this health announcement is described repeatedly as an investment. Now, partly because it's capital spending that they're talking about, spending on equipment and buildings. But I think when you look at Keir Starmer's speech yesterday, which used the word invest or investment 15 times, I think you can see that this is a government anxious about how its tax rises, higher borrowing and spending cuts are going to be received tomorrow, and is trying to argue in advance that these aren't just higher taxes and higher borrowing, in order to stand still, in order to plug the £22 billion black hole, which they've talked about for months, but actually to invest in public services. They are trying to argue that these are tax rises with a purpose. Of course, we'll find out the precise details tomorrow.
And, you know, looking around what else has been speculated on, some of the speculation in the papers is concerning, certainly in the Times, that the minimum wage could rise by more than inflation. Again, an investment. What do we know on this? That's how it's being described.
Yeah, this is in actually a few papers over the last couple of days. It's not something we've stood up for ourselves, but we do have a public comment from the Low Pay Commission just a few weeks ago, which recommends to the government the annual rate of increase in the minimum wage, which said that they expected the current rate for those aged 21 and over, also known as the national living wage, slightly confusingly, to increase from £11.44 an hour to £12.12 an hour, an increase of more than 6%. The new government very early on set a new remit for that low pay commission, which said they wanted to make sure they boosted low earnings. So that's one reason why actually what they end up recommending might be higher than what they said a few weeks ago. This would all take effect in April 2025. Now, the Low Pay Commission looks at how an increase in the minimum wage would affect businesses. So there will be an element of consideration of a higher wage bill for businesses. But then when you add into that the inevitability, as it now is, that the employer's rate of national insurance will increase, I think you can see that this government could have to do some explaining, especially to small businesses, about why this won't be a burden that will just fall on them.
Henry Zeffman, thank you.
It's 20 to 7 now. There are renewed fears for the provision of food and other essential supplies in Gaza after the Israeli parliament voted to ban UNRWA, a UN agency and the main organisation working in Gaza. The ban includes contact with Israeli officials. Yolan Nell, our correspondent, joins us from Jerusalem. What will that mean in practice on the ground in Gaza, Yolan?
I mean, there's 3 months before this is due to be implemented, but this is threatening to have a very profound impact because you have, following this vote, which I should say was overwhelmingly in favour in the Israeli parliament, two butts of the legislation. One bars UNRWA operations in Israeli territory, so that will include Israeli annexed East Jerusalem, and the other bars state authorities from having any contact with the agency. So, you know, without coordination with Israel, it will be virtually impossible for UNRWA to do its work in Gaza and in the occupied West Bank as well. They won't be able to get entry permits for international staff. They won't be able to do Israeli military coordination.
And just so I understand that is the kind of coordination that, for example, allows an aid truck to pass because they make contact with the Israeli authorities and they ask for a convoy to be deconflicted, i.e. protected.
Exactly, because Israel controls the borders into Gaza. At the moment, you don't even have the option of access via Egypt. So right now, all of the aid that is going in has to be coordinated with the Israeli authorities, as does the entrance of course, international staff.
And the reason that has been put forward, not only in Parliament, but indeed by the Israeli Prime Minister himself, has been the accusations about connections with Hamas. And UNRWA did fire 9 people accused by Israel, saying that they might have been included in October the 7th. But how many employees overall does UNRWA have? How great is its reach?
So, I mean, overall, you're talking about an agency that provides services, education, healthcare aid to more than 5 million sort of Palestinians in Gaza, the West Bank, and also elsewhere in the region, in Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria. It employs more than 30,000 people, and most of them are indeed themselves counted as Palestinian refugees. So it is a huge employer, and in Gaza, which is historically sort of, you know, made up of Palestinian refugees in the main, has 8 urban refugee camps. You can see why UNRWA has been such an important agency. It's the biggest UN agency on the ground in Gaza.
Yolan Nell, thank you.
Let's have a look at 17 minutes to 7 at some of the papers this morning, and most of them leading on the story that we've been talking about. Tax rises will not cure the NHS. That's what's Labour's concessional. Certainly that's how some of the papers position it. Yes, at the same time as we were hearing from Henry Zeffman, where the Labour government itself, the government wants to position this as an investment, and that this is the start of this, and positioning also of years of Tory failure, depending on which paper you look at. But just also to draw your attention, I suppose, it's linked to health, and we'll return to that story a bit later in the programme when we hear from the Health Secretary just after 8 o'clock, is at the front page of the Times and a few of the other papers talking about the fertility rate hitting a record low in this country. That links, of course, to the NHS and politics and the way that we live, and also the cost of living. There's some interesting analysis inside the paper on this about Generation Z, Gen Z. Only 20% of women born in 97, the start of Gen Z, had a child before the age of 25. So women getting older and women having fewer children. But this is being described as women in this cohort as and actually women and men as very non-natal. It's a very low priority for them. And what are we going to do about that? Much discussion on that.
And one other story in the papers, the Financial Times, is leading on what it says is the first closure of a Volkswagen factory in 87 years. In fact, Volkswagen plans to shut at least three German plants, which means it's going to axe tens of thousands of jobs, and also it's going to slash pay by 10%. It's a major restructuring, and the FT says it's going to set up a battle with powerful unions and politicians in Germany, where VW has 300,000 employees.
That's a huge amount. It's 16 minutes to seven. Returning to UK politics, it may seem hard to believe, but try to think of this. There was a time when the contents of the budget were closely guarded secret. And yesterday in Parliament, an angry Commons Speaker, Sir Lindsay Hoyle, criticised the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, for revealing some of her plans before her big statement tomorrow. Here's our correspondent, Sean Curran.
In just a few hours, Rachel Reeves will mark Budget Eve by taking part in a regular question and answer session with MPs. Traditionally, on these occasions, Treasury ministers bat away any questions about the contents of the budget. But Sir Lindsay Hoyle thinks the Chancellor has already said too much. The Speaker complained that last week, Rachel Reeves had told journalists and not Parliament about her plans to change the way the government measured debt.
These are major new policy announcements with significant and wide-ranging implication for the government's fiscal policy and for the public finances. It is evident to me this should therefore have been made in the first instance in this House and not to the world's media.
Warming to his theme, Sir Lindsay said he was very disappointed that the Chancellor expected MPs to wait until Wednesday to hear her repeat her announcements in the budget statement.
Honourable members may be wondering how they will get a seat on Wednesday. Well, to be quite honest, the way it's going, you won't need to. We'll have all the verdict first in here. It's not acceptable. I don't want it to continue. And I want to treat this House with the respect it deserves. I'm not with this side or that side. It is totally unacceptable to go around the world telling everybody rather than these members. They were elected by the constituents of this country and they deserve to be treated better.
A couple of hours later, a Treasury Minister, Darren Jones, made a statement to MPs about the changes to the debt rules. He didn't refer to the Speaker's comments, but the Prime Minister's official spokesman told reporters that it was entirely routine for the government to make announcements in the press in the run-up to the budget. Last week, the Chancellor explained that she planned to change the rules to free up billions of pounds to spend on projects like roads, schools and hospitals. Darren Jones told the Commons that would help fix the foundations and rebuild Britain.
The inherited plans we received from the last government would have seen public sector investment decline to the lowest level in over 10 years. A path of declining investment is the path of a declining nation, and we refuse to follow it.
A Conservative shadow Treasury Minister, Gareth Davis, said Treasury officials had advised Tory ministers that increased borrowing would lead to interest rates staying higher for longer. And he accused Rachel Reeves of breaking a promise that she wouldn't change the rules.
This Labour government are quick to spend, but unwilling to explain. So can I ask the Chief Secretary finally, on behalf of the British people and the markets who are watching this statement so very nervously, what definition of public debt is the UK offering to lenders today? And how much does the government plan to borrow under an expanded definition? I know he'll say that we have to wait for the budget, but the Chancellor didn't wait last week, so why should we?
Darren Jones wasn't impressed.
He has some brass neck standing up in this House telling this government how to behave after the years of his party's maladministration over the last 14 years. And might I just politely point out that he might be getting slightly ahead of himself. The Chancellor has not set out the detail of the fiscal rules in advance of the budget, because she will do it to this House at the budget on Wednesday, and I encourage him to wait for that information.
For the Liberal Democrats, Daisy Cooper joined in the criticism of the Conservatives.
Under the Conservatives, the fiscal rules changed 5 times in 7 years. So a change to fiscal rules in and of themselves is not that unusual. So, but would the Minister agree with me that what would be completely unforgivable would be a repeat of the Conservatives' disastrous mini-budget when they tried to pursue £40 billion worth of unfunded tax cuts, which left a long shadow on our public finances?
Back in July, 7 Labour MPs had the whip suspended for 6 months after they rebelled and backed a call to scrap the two-child cap, a rule which stops almost all parents from claiming universal credit or child tax credit for more than 2 children. One of the 7, Zara Sultana, challenged Darren Jones.
There are no fiscal rules, only fiscal choices. While task forces meet, more and more children in Coventry South and across the country are consigned to avoidable poverty. When will the government acknowledge this, prioritise it, ending child poverty and finally scrap the pernicious two-child benefit cap?
Darren Jones said the Child Poverty Task Force reported last week, and the Chancellor would set out in the budget how the government would reduce child poverty by the next election.
Sean Curran reporting. The time is 10 to 7. The daughter of the murdered MP Sir David Amos has told us the family have been left with no way to pursue the full background as to how he was stabbed and killed during a constituency surgery in Southend in Essex 3 years ago. A coroner has now said there's no evidence the death was preventable. Katie Amos's criticism includes of the actions of Essex police. This is why.
The night before it happened to my dad, my brother received a phone call saying that my father was going to be killed. So he reported it to the police instantly. Obviously, you would presume, given that there was a death threat to a member of parliament, they would turn up at his surgery the next day to protect him.
The police, you mean?
Yes, the police should have turned up to protect him.
Well, Daniel Sanford, our Home Affairs correspondent, is with us now. And after we recorded that interview, Daniel, we did go to Essex Police for a statement. It's quite a lengthy statement we got back in response. Just take us through the contrast and the details that we have between what they say and what the Amos family say.
Yes, and we've also got a third source on this, which is the coroner who has made a judgment this year as to why he's not reopening the inquest into Sir David's death. Essentially, it does seem that Sir David's son received a phone call in which threats to harm both Sir David's son and Sir David were made. The coroner didn't accept that it was death threats, but they were threats of harm. The son did contact Essex Police, and the coroner has laid out in some detail what was done by Essex Police that night. But what, of course, wasn't done by Essex Police was that extra police force officers were not deployed to the constituency surgery the next day, where by coincidence, a man, Ali Harbi Ali, did turn up and stab him more than 20 times and kill him. But Essex Police subsequently established that the phone call was completely unlinked to the horrific murder. It was essentially a sort of a semi-domestic set of threats that were made to Sir David's son and to his father. And it was on those grounds that the coroner decided that, though it was a really horrific coincidence, because it didn't have any direct bearing on the death, that therefore he wasn't going to open the inquest on those grounds. Though, of course, Sir David's daughter, Katie Amos, points out that if they had stepped up security the next day, then police officers would have been present when Ali Harbi Ali turned up and stabbed her father. And so she's very keen that that should still be examined in the context of an inquest.
Yeah. And we'll have her comments in full in the interview that will run at 7:30. Overall, it is not the only agency of the state. The police are not the only ones that the Amos family feel deeply wounded by. And there is this sense overall that they're left with nowhere to go now to try and understand how this terrible event could have happened.
Yes, I mean, as Katie Amos puts it, there's been no public investigation of preventability into her father's death. The man who killed Sir David Amos had 5 years earlier been referred to the Prevent scheme by his school. He was at that point at school. He was part of the Prevent scheme for a couple of years because of concerns about extremism. But as he put it at his trial, he had sort of deliberately said all the right things when being investigated by the Prevent scheme and under the supervision of the Prevent scheme. And by the time he dropped out of university in 2016 to focus on jihad, he had the Prevent scheme had stopped its interest in him, and he was no longer part of the Prevent scheme, something that Katie Amos says was an admin error. Either way, I think it is accepted by all parties that Ali Harbi Ali deliberately went dark. He deliberately made clear that he wasn't involved in extremism anymore, and it was on that basis that the coroner has said, well, yes, although he was involved in the Prevent scheme, it doesn't mean that there was a state failure to monitor him over the subsequent 3 years, and therefore there isn't a need to open an inquest on those grounds either.
Daniel Sanford, thanks.
6 minutes to seven. In a landmark case, a male student has been jailed for 18 years after creating and selling AI child abuse images from real images of children. But how are these images created? How convincing are they becoming? And what would it be like to actually see some of these images, to go through them? Well, our next guest has experience of that. Tamsin McNally, Internet Watch Foundation's hotline manager, who does see some of these images on a daily basis. Tamsin, good morning.
Good morning.
Can I start firstly by your reaction to this verdict, 18 years imprisonment?
Mm-hmm. It's a really, really appalling crime that's happened. And I think it's a very serious crime. And I think the sentence that was handed down kind of reflects the seriousness of what has happened. It's unfortunately something that we're seeing more and more happening with images that are using AI software to generate some of the kinds of worst situations that you could think of.
So are the situations real, or how is AI being mm-hmm. used with the images of real children? Could you explain mm-hmm. the distinction?
Absolutely. So AI is a method of creation. So in my team, in my hotline, we are seeing images that are either completely synthetic, so people can put in particular prompts using some pieces of software to create indecent images of children. But also what we're seeing more and more of actually, and is what seems to happen in this case, is that there are images of real children. And it could be completely benign images that any parent might take of their children and post online. These real images are being taken, being run through software, and then being digitally manipulated in order to put them into new situations, which is absolutely horrifying for any parent, I think, out there listening to think that this could happen to an image of their children. And in this case, Nelson was profiting from this material. It was being made to order. People were going to him saying, here is an image, please can you take it and create a new situation with this child in it.
Yes, Hugh Nelson, 27 years of age, from mm-hmm. Bolton, was making money from this, mm-hmm. a graphic design student. He also encouraged the rape of children in online mm-hmm. chat rooms, just to give more of that detail, as horrifying as it is. But what mm-hmm. you were just saying there, that so there's two ways AI is being used, there's more, but the way that you've mm-hmm. identified. And some will involve the harm in real life of children because that image already exists and then can be augmented mm-hmm. in some way. And some will be children whose image are just on the internet and they haven't been abused in real life, if I could say that.
Yes, that's true. Sadly, we at the Internet Watch Foundation look at hundreds of thousands of indecent images all day, every day, and we work to remove them online, whether they're created by AI or not. Yes. The resulting image, the impact is the same, but quite often we see images of victims who were abused many, many years ago, and we're seeing them again now, but in a different way. So those images have been manipulated. And with AI, I think the thing is that you are only limited by your imagination.
Well, so it's a lamp. We're going to have to leave it there. I'm so sorry, but it was fascinating to hear what you're able to tell us. Tamsin McNally, and it's a landmark case. Thank you.
It is coming up to 7 o'clock.
What have we got?
On BBC iPlayer.
All I know is somebody's behind all this.
You can just walk away.
You should investigate. I got the
blues. These aren't crime dramas.
What the hell are you playing at?
They're a break from your work dramas.
How does all this make you feel?
Well done, everybody.
Dead and Buried, Line of Duty, Luther, and loads more.
We're throwing you a lifeline here, mate.
Whoever you are, wherever you stream, BBC iPlayer.
Let's just get the latest on the weather from Sarah Keith Lucas.
Thanks, Emma. Another fairly cloudy day out there for most of us today. We've got high pressure keeping things largely dry and settled. This morning, some early mist and some fog patches that should gradually lift and clear, but most of the UK is going to keep a lot of fairly grey skies and cloud. There'll be some sunshine breaking through it at times, though, and I think the best of the sunshine will be for eastern Scotland today and northeast England too, but some sunny spells also for parts of Wales and southern England as well. Temperatures are going to range between around 14 to perhaps 17, north to south for most of us. A little bit cooler across the far north of Scotland, just 11 or 12, but some sunshine towards the Northern Isles and the Western Isles later on in the day. Overnight tonight, things are staying fairly quiet, and then the next few days, largely dry with variable amounts of cloud and still mild.
Sarah, thank you very much. You're listening to Today on Radio 4.
Good morning. If you're just joining us, it's 7 o'clock on Tuesday, the 29th of October. The headlines this morning. There's been an international outcry over a decision by Israel to ban the UN's main Palestinian relief agency. After the news, we'll hear from the chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee here, the Labour MP, Emily Thornberry. Ministers have announced more money for NHS equipment, saying it will help to arrest the decline of the health service. And dangerous super-strength opioids have been found in fake medicines being sold online to people in the UK.
And coming up before 8 o'clock, buffer zones around abortion clinics come into force this week in England and Wales. We'll hear from those who need to access them and get help, and those who have been able to protest outside.
It takes away the element of them being able to, you know, potentially intimidate and harass the people that are coming in for treatment for us.
We don't intimidate people here. We're not an aggressive people.
And a lost Mayan city has been discovered under the Mexican jungle.
I was expecting to see a lot of houses. I was not expecting to see palaces, temples, causeways, ball courts, but that's what we found. It was really incredible.
The BBC News is read by Vigi Alice.
Israel's allies have condemned a decision by the Israeli parliament to ban the UN's Palestinian Refugee Agency from working within the country, warning that it plays a critical role in delivering humanitarian assistance to Gaza. Israel has accused UNRWA staff of involvement in the 7th of October attacks and diverting aid in Gaza. Sir Keir Starmer said he was gravely concerned about the ban. Our Middle East correspondent Yolan Nell reports from Jerusalem.
Despite widespread international opposition, Israeli MPs voted overwhelmingly to approve two bills. These essentially bar UNRWA from operating in Israel and annexed East Jerusalem and severely curtail its ability to work in the occupied West Bank and Gaza, where it's the largest UN agency playing a vital role in distributing aid and running wartime shelters. The UNRWA spokeswoman, Julia Tuma, says the legislation breaches the UN Charter and Israel's obligations under international law.
The vote by the Israeli parliament is unprecedented. It's a threat to our common humanity. It's time to allow us to do our work. Just allow us to do our work. Enough. Enough.
Israeli officials accuse UNRWA of being complicit with Hamas and cite the involvement of a handful of its thousands of staff in the 7th of October attacks. The agency insists it's impartial. Responding to the new laws, the UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres insisted that UNRWA is indispensable.
The authorities in Lebanon say 60 people have been killed by Israeli strikes in the eastern Bekaa Valley. The Iran-backed group Hezbollah has a strong presence in the region. Our Middle East correspondent Hugo Bashega sent this report from Beirut.
The Israeli airstrikes happened at night and came with no warning. 16 areas were hit, officials say, with two children among the dead. As morning broke, emergency teams continued to search the rubble for possible survivors. In the town of Budai, residents pleaded on social media for heavy equipment to be sent to help rescue people believed to be trapped. The governor of Baalbek called the strikes the most violent in his region since Israel escalated its conflict with Hezbollah last month. The group has a strong presence in the Bekaa Valley, which is a strategic route to its allies and backers in Syria, Iraq and Iran.
The government has announced some details of its plan to fix what it is calling 14 years of damage done to the NHS by the Conservatives. £1.5 billion will be invested in equipment and buildings. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, said the move would help to arrest the decline in the health service, but warned there could still be patients waiting on trolleys and in corridors this winter. The Conservatives say they delivered record funding for the NHS. Here's our health editor, Hugh Pym.
For the first time, the government has set out some of its detailed thinking on how to reduce England's waiting list of 7.64 million. The Treasury says £1.8 billion of extra money has been provided to the NHS since the election for more operations and appointments. There'll be £1.57 billion allocated next year for equipment including scanners and radiotherapy machines. The extra money announced by Westminster will also lead to increased budgets in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. These are some but not all of the government's plans for the NHS. The budget will reveal the overall spending numbers and how these compare with the trend in previous years. The Health Foundation think tank welcomed the funding on equipment but said there were unanswered questions, including investment in staff and how the NHS would use technology.
Super-strength synthetic opioid drugs, which have been linked to hundreds of deaths, have been found in samples of fake medicines in the UK. They were sold online, purporting to treat conditions such as anxiety and insomnia. The opioids, called nitazenes, can be stronger than heroin, and even a tiny amount can lead to a fatal overdose. Our correspondent, Navtej Johal, reports.
It's believed nitazenes are being made in illicit labs in China and are arriving in the UK by post. They'd been found previously in many heroin samples. But BBC analysis of data from the National Drug Testing Service, Wedinos, shows nitazenes were detected 130 times in the 12 months to September in contaminated medicines sent in anonymously after being bought online. An expert in illicit synthetic drugs from the United Nations, Martin Reitelhuber, says the BBC's findings mirror the start of the opioid crisis in the United States.
There's a lesson to learn from North America, where the expansion of the opioid crisis was driven by populations consuming prescription medicines. So here in Europe, we are not yet in that situation, but this could be the early signs.
15 synthetic opioids have been banned in the UK this year, and there are proposals to outlaw more. But experts are calling for urgent action, including more drug testing.
With a week to go until polling stations open for the US presidential election, the Republican candidate Donald Trump has told a rally in the crucial swing state of Georgia that he's not a Nazi. Mr. Trump has been accused by his opponents of wanting to become an authoritarian leader. Last week, the former White House chief of staff, John Kelly, told the New York Times that as president, Mr. Trump had said he wanted generals like Adolf Hitler had. Speaking in Atlanta, Donald Trump insisted the comparisons were unfair.
They use that word freely, both words. They use it, he's Hitler. And then they say, he's a Nazi. I'm not a Nazi. I'm the opposite of a Nazi.
Officials in the U.S. say hundreds of voting slips have been destroyed by arson attacks on ballot drop-off boxes in Oregon and Washington State. Police in the city of Portland say they have identified a suspicious vehicle and the motive isn't clear. A 26-year-old man has died while in detention at Brookhouse Immigration Removal Centre near Gatwick Airport. The centre is managed by the contractor Serco, which confirmed the man had died on Sunday. The Home Office has said its condolences are with his family. The Conservative leadership candidate, Kemi Badenoch, has said she will tone down her approach after some of her colleagues suggested she can be rude. The shadow housing secretary is widely tipped to beat her rival, Robert Jendrick, when the result of the contest is announced on Saturday. Speaking to the BBC's newscast, Mrs. Badenoch said she put her demeanour down to having a higher threshold for stress.
I don't think I'm being rude. I just think I'm saying something that I wouldn't mind hearing back. So I treat people how I treat myself. I'm not perfect. You know, I've never said that I was perfect. We keep wanting people who will give the perfect interview and have the perfect policies, will look perfect. There's nobody like that.
And you can hear the full interview with Kemi Badenoch on Newscast on BBC Sounds. A group of PhD students has stumbled upon a huge ancient city hidden underground in the Mexican jungle. The researchers found it while running specialist tools for archaeology over an existing radar map of the area. Scientists say it is one of the largest Mayan sites in South America, as our science reporter Georgina Renard explains.
The archaeologists found the site under the jungle canopy in the southeastern state of Campeche by accident during an internet search. A PhD student spotted a radar survey posted by an environmental organization that could peer through thick vegetation. Using archaeological tools, the researchers were able to see evidence of nearly 7,000 buildings and a huge city they called Valeriana. The settlement spanned an area the size of Edinburgh. Valeriana had temple pyramids, plazas, houses, causeways and reservoirs, and may have been home to up to 50,000 people in the 9th century. Lucol Thomas from Tulane University says it reveals the complexity of Mayan society. But war, climate change and the Spanish invasion led to the demise of most Mayans.
Georgina Renard reporting.
Thank you. It's 9 minutes past seven. Israel's parliament has voted to pass legislation banning the UN's Palestinian Refugee Agency, referred to as UNRWA, from operating within Israel and Israeli-occupied East Jerusalem within 3 months. Contact between UNRWA employees and Israeli officials will also be banned, which will limit the agency's ability to operate in Gaza and the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Israel has objected to UNRWA for decades, although this opposition has intensified in recent years. UNRWA has sacked 9 employees this year for alleged involvement in the October the 7th attacks and for working with Hamas. The Labour MP Emily Thornberry is chair of the Parliament over here, Parliament's Foreign Affairs Select Committee, which meets for the first time today. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us. Your response, first of all, to Israel's decision to do this, and there's been much outcry from Israel's allies.
Okay, well, let me just say, obviously, the committee has yet to meet, so I'm speaking in a personal capacity. However, I think that I speak on behalf of many in Parliament who are profoundly alarmed by what is going on here. UNRWA was created at the same time as Israel. There was a UN general resolution that established UNRWA, and Israel must abide by its international obligations. There has been condemnation of this in a joint statement from, I think Britain made a joint statement with Canada, Australia, France, Germany, Japan, and the Republic of Korea. I mean, it's the international community is horrified to see this. It has been as you've said, there has been a long campaign to delegitimize and discredit UNRWA.
Just to be clear, that's not what I said. I talked of Israel objecting to UNRWA and also UNRWA then sacking 9 employees for alleged involvement in the October 7th attacks.
Sorry. There has been a long-standing campaign to delegitimize and discredit UNRWA, which has also included, of course, discrediting it in this country, and the previous government suspended funding to UNRWA. The current government has re-established funding with UNRWA because we believe that the work that UNRWA does is absolutely vital, particularly at a time like this. I mean, 650,000 children are educated because of UNRWA on the West Bank and in Gaza. And obviously, we all know there are people in northern Gaza at the moment who, it is said, are starving. This is not the time to be cutting links with the United Nations organization that was established to support and assist Palestinians.
You talk about a campaign to discredit UNRWA, but if we look at what the Office of Benjamin Netanyahu has said, it's prepared to work with international partners, both in the days before the legislation takes place to ensure and afterwards to ensure humanitarian aid would still reach Gazan civilians. And also it's been working already with the World Food Programme, UNICEF and other agencies. There is just this point to put to you, though, around Israel alleges that more than 10% of UNRWA's staff in Gaza have ties to terrorist factions, that educational facilities under the organisation's auspices consistently incite hatred of Israel and glorify terror. There was a report only last week carried, for instance, in the Times of Israel, other places as well, around a Hamas commander killed in an Israeli strike. UNRWA confirmed that commander who led the killing and kidnapping of Israelis from a roadside bomb shelter on October the 7th had been employed by UNRWA. That's to give some of that context. Do you see that as part of a campaign to discredit, or does that give you some understanding of how your equivalents, your, the MPs in Israel, as it were, have voted?
Yes. I mean, I've spoken to UNRWA about this, and I've talked to them about their systems for ensuring that their staff are strictly impartial. And it's right. They've said that they have found people who they've dismissed because of their allegiances have been completely inappropriate. And given the size of the staff that they have, and given that they recruit on the ground, there will be times when they have recruited the wrong people and those people are dismissed. But to tarnish all of UNRWA and all of the work that it does with that brush, because a tiny minority have been found to be Hamas supporters, is simply to get things completely out of proportion and to unfairly delegitimize and discredit UNRWA.
Emily Thornberry, as you say, the Foreign Affairs Select Committee is to meet, speaking there in a personal capacity, the Labour MP, though, giving her view to that news. Thank you.
14 minutes past seven. More scanners, surgical hubs and radiotherapy equipment will be funded for the NHS next year. We've learnt it's a day before the budget. This announcement, part of health spending plans to be revealed in full by the Chancellor tomorrow. The Health Secretary will join us live in an hour's time. Overall, the government promises for 40,000 more appointments and procedures a week by next July. Waiting lists have risen since the election this July. Saffron Cordery is Deputy Chief Executive of NHS Providers. Its members include hospitals, mental health trusts, community and ambulance services. Good morning, Saffron.
Good morning.
What do you think of what we've heard today?
Well, I think it's worth saying this is really a welcome additional funding against a backdrop of significant financial and economic challenges across public services, and capital investment is very important. So this starts the process of rebuilding the NHS and investing in the capital that the NHS needs. But I think it's worth saying that this is a really long-term endeavour, and we need to think about not just the investment in capital, but also the running costs that go with that investment in capital. The two need to go hand in hand.
When you say running costs, do you mean staff costs?
I mean staff costs. I mean the day-to-day costs of helping a hospital run. So particularly staff costs, but you know, wider costs as well, drug costs, things like that, which we know are rising.
OK, so what is the real terms increase, the percentage real terms increase that you are looking for in the announcement tomorrow to give you confidence that the health service is going to be put in better shape?
I think we need to remember that this has to be a both financially sustainable and a sustainable undertaking for the whole of the NHS. We know that the mooted 4% will give the NHS around £7 billion. Pay rises are already going to cost £3 billion for the NHS. So that probably leaves the NHS with about £2 billion. We need significantly more than that. But what I would say is that whilst we need the investment in getting the waiting lists down, we also need investment across the whole of the NHS. So that's getting mental health service waiting lists down, community waiting lists down. It's also about making sure that ambulance response times go up. But critically, the NHS works hand in hand with other parts of the public sector. And I think the one thing I would say is we desperately need to invest in social care and local government if we're going to resolve all of the issues that we are seeing across the NHS, including significantly rising demand and the challenges with flow of patients through hospitals, particularly at times of high emergency pressures.
So if there isn't investment in social care in this budget, are you saying that it will be difficult or even impossible to get to 40,000 more appointments and procedures a week by next July, because the flow in the hospital just won't allow that? There won't be the discharges. The hospital won't run as it should.
I think we will get some way towards achieving that 40,000 appointments, because the interdependencies are different depending on the kind of hospital state. So where we have surgical hubs, that works very well because you can divide off the emergency part of a hospital's operation from the routine procedures, and that really helps. So this investment will go some way towards starting to get that really ticking over and working like clockwork. But we don't have that everywhere because the NHS estate isn't fit for purpose at the moment. We've got nearly £14 billion worth of backlog maintenance that needs to happen to get the NHS estate really functioning. So I think we know that investment in social care, investment in wider capital, and investment in workforce on an ongoing basis are the things we need. But this is really welcome additional funding.
Saffron Caudry, thank you. 18 minutes past seven. Sean's back. Oil prices have tumbled at the start of the week. I just made that sound like it was your fault. But Sean Farrington has the latest on BP's profit.
Yeah, which also nothing directly to do with me as well. But we were hearing an hour ago how that oil price had fallen 6% yesterday to $71 for a barrel of Brent crude. That was after Israel's attack on Iran at the weekend avoided major energy infrastructure. And BP saying this morning profits in its third quarter of its financial year, three-month period, down from $3.3 billion in the same period last year to $2.3 billion this year. Its lowest profits for a certain quarter since the pandemic of 2020. Nick Butler, former BP executive, now visiting professor at King's College London. Why the fall in profits to such a low level, Nick? Hello, Nick. Do we have Nick on the line? Maybe we don't have Nick on the line, but a lot of those profits, Michelle, I'll tell you a little bit of as I look into the small print of why some of those profits are falling.
Don't worry, Sean, you were going to start asking me the questions. No, you were ready with the questions, then you looked across at me.
No, but everybody has a view because of the impact on petrol and diesel prices as well. So they will have noticed, maybe as much as BP have, that over the course of the last year, the oil price has been lower and maybe lower than people expected. Certainly a few weeks ago with the escalations in the Middle East, people were closely following the oil price, waiting perhaps for a big increase, and that hasn't come. And part of that is why BP, maybe their outlook for profits might not be quite what some expected if the oil price was higher. And that will have a bit of a consequence when Rachel Reeves comes to doing the numbers on her budget and the windfall tax. If the oil price is at a lower level and profits for the likes of BP at a lower level, then windfall taxes may well come in at a lower level as well. I'm going to put that question to Nick Butler, formerly of BP. Nick, just wonder what your impression is on the outlook for the oil price now and the impact on profits for BP, potential windfall tax revenues for the British government.
I think my outlook would be that this is about the price we're going to see for the next period unless there is an all-out war in the Middle East. Which doesn't now look likely. I mean, Chinese demand is down, Russian supply is strong despite all the sanctions, and US exports are strong. So I think this is the world we're operating in, and it will have an effect on BP, on other companies, and also it removes the windfall that people are hoping will add extra taxes. There's no windfall at these prices.
And so where does the windfall start kicking in if we are monitoring the oil price?
On the legislation, the windfall kicks in at about $71. That's the definition per barrel for Brent crude. And we're now at that level, and I think it could go down a bit more. So the real problem for BP and other people is that their share prices are driven by the oil prices. And I think now people will be looking at BP share price with great intensity.
We'll keep a close eye on that at 8 o'clock when the stock market's open. Nick, thank you very much. We got there. Nick Butler, former BP executive now at King's College London.
Sean, thank you. 22 minutes past seven. An extraordinary discovery has been made in Mexico. The remains, it appears, of a Mayan city under the ground, revealed when PhD student Luke Hall-Thomas of Tulane University found a data set of radar images gathered by environmental scientists.
The discovery was entirely serendipitous. I read an academic paper that some colleagues wrote where they reanalyzed some environmental data
from Mexico, data collected by environmental scientists and looked at it for its archaeological value. And I thought, that's pretty cool. Where there's one, there's usually more. And so I just set about poking around online and did a deep dive and eventually turned up with this real treasure of a data set. And so we downloaded it and looked at it from an archaeological perspective. And through a very happy coincidence, the survey happened to target an area of great archaeological interest, but about which relatively little was known. I was expecting to see a lot of houses. I was not expecting to see palaces, temples, causeways, ball courts, the full spectrum of Maya urbanism on display in this data set. But that's what we found. It was really incredible.
And there are images in the story written up on the BBC News website about this, where you can get a sense of what he's describing. The site is in the Mexican jungle, inland, about 100 kilometres from Calakmul, which is an extensive site with pyramids abandoned in about 900 AD. Professor Elizabeth Graham of University College London is with us. She's an expert in Mayan civilization. Welcome, Professor. Thank you. What do you think of what these researchers say they found?
Well, their survey was actually more extensive than just that particular site. And so what had the most meaning for me was that the three areas that they looked at all showed evidence of habitation. So even if the other areas didn't have as large structures, the fact that there was settlement everywhere that was Maya settlement was really fascinating.
And does it make sense that there would be another large settlement, as this appears, about 100 kilometres away from this very substantial and important site where there are pyramids rising above the ground?
Well, it's forest. And I don't know if you've ever walked through the forest, but you can miss structures easily. You know, you might not miss a structure that's, 31 metres high, or you might know it's there, like the locals, and not comment on it, even where I'm working now, no one has worked north and south of us along the lagoon, and there are large structures.
Would you be keen then to go and see this site for yourself and see what is visible above the ground?
Well, I don't think they've excavated it, so I think it's just the topography that reveals these buildings. But it wouldn't be unusual to have those features. It's just that area hasn't been, explored. But also the important thing is, which they mention in their article, that some of my colleagues have been skeptical about the LIDAR that's been carried out over the last 10 years, let's say.
This is the radar.
Yeah, the LIDAR, it's conducted when people work at particular sites and then manage to get the funding to do the LIDAR survey. So it tends to focus on these sites and the periphery. But then my colleagues, some of them say, well, that doesn't prove that there are sites everywhere. You know, it just proves that there are sites near.
It does seem from these images that there is quite a lot under the ground here.
Yeah.
What are the chances of this site being excavated? What are the rules? What's the inclination or the funding for that in Mexico today?
Well, I don't know. I work in Belize. I don't work in Mexico. But someone would have to get a grant to work there. So maybe one of the Mexican researchers will do that. But it's very expensive, and it's difficult these days to get funding for those kinds of excavations. So we see fewer of them. But hopefully, perhaps, a Mexican scholar can get a grant.
And it sounds as if the topography is particularly difficult, as you were saying, right in the middle of the jungle.
Well, yeah, it is.
Professor Elizabeth Graham, thanks very much.
It's 26 minutes past seven. Let's get the latest on the sport from Carthy.
Morning, thank you very much. Manchester United are in talks with Portugal's Ruben Amorim about becoming their new manager after Erik ten Hag was sacked yesterday. We can speak to the BBC's chief sports news reporter, Simon Stone. Morning, Simon. Ruben Amorim might not be the most well-known name given the likes of Gareth Southgate. Thomas Tuchel had previously been linked with the job. When did Amorim become front of that list?
Well, Amorim's well-known around Europe. He's one of the most progressive coaches. He's done very, very well at Sporting. He ended their 19-year wait for a league title and then added another last year. He spoke to West Ham over their managerial vacancy in April. I think there were discussions around the Liverpool situation as well. He decided to stay at Sporting. We thought he was going to stay at Sporting for the whole of this season and possibly would have come into contention to replace Pep Guardiola if Pep Guardiola left Manchester City at the end of this season, which is probably not going to happen. So he is on people's radars. And I think Manchester United, having made the decision they made yesterday to sack Erik ten Hag, have quickly decided that Amorim is the right man to take them forward or lift them out of the position that they find themselves in right now.
Yeah, he is an impressive character, but Manchester United have an English League Cup tie against Leicester City tomorrow. What is the timescale for them potentially now appointing a new manager if it is Amorim?
Well, I think it's unlikely that would happen in time for him to play any active role against Leicester. Ruud van Nistelrooy is in interim charge, but I think Sporting have a game in the Portuguese Cup this evening. It wouldn't surprise me if very quickly this was done and there was a possibility of Amorim being in charge for the Premier League game against Chelsea on Sunday. This is all moving very, very quickly. There are details that are still sketchy. There's not an agreement as yet, but I think Manchester United are very, very keen to get this done quickly.
And as someone who follows the comings and goings at Old Trafford very closely, as you do, was Erik ten Hag potentially given more time than you might have expected, given United's results? They're in 14th place in the Premier League.
Well, that's right. And I think basically by winning, not just winning the FA Cup, but the manner of it, that persuaded the Manchester United hierarchy, the Ineos group, Sir Jim Ratcliffe, the new co-owner, to give him more time to prove beating Manchester City at Wembley wasn't a fluke. And it's just unravelled very, very quickly. And it appears it was a fluke, and no club of the size of Manchester United anywhere, I could argue, is happy at being 14th in the league. And if they are 14th in the league, the scrutiny is going to be on the manager, and it can't be any surprise whatsoever that he's lost his job, even though he will be compensated for that.
Yeah.
And Manchester United will have to pay compensation to get Amorim out of Sporting.
Yeah. Simon Stone, thank you very much for that. Just a few other headlines for you. Wales women must win the second leg of their Euro 2025 playoff semi-final against Slovakia tonight to keep their hopes of reaching the tournament alive. Scotland, Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland also have competitive matches. And the Manchester City and Spain midfielder Rodri won the men's Ballon d'Or, awarded to the best footballer of the year. The Spain and Barcelona midfielder Aitana Bonmatí won the women's Ballon d'Or.
Carthy, thanks very much. It's 7:30. Let's tell you about something a little bit spooky awaiting us this evening.
Uncanny, with me, Danny Robbins, on BBC Radio 4.
As I glanced up, I saw a woman in a red robe walking up the stairs.
More real-life accounts of the paranormal.
And all of a sudden we heard an almighty scream.
To kick off a trilogy of terror, I'm joined by the parapsychologist Evelyn Hollow.
It's supposed to be that if you see this wild hunt, something bad is going to happen.
And the writer and comedian Stuart Lee.
I'm very glad that I had that experience, but I don't believe it happened.
Uncanny on BBC Sounds and Radio 4. Beginning tonight at 11.
The weather, it's going to be a largely cloudy day with some drizzle and some sunny spells. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Emma Barnett, Michelle Hussein and Vigi Alice with the news.
Israel's allies, including the UK and the US, have condemned a parliamentary vote banning the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees from operating in the country. Israel has accused some staff from UNRWA of being involved in the 7th of October attacks. The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said the new law would have devastating consequences. Officials in Gaza say 55 people have been killed by an Israeli airstrike in the north of the territory. Reports say a residential building was hit in the town of Beit Lahia. Israel has not yet commented. The government has unveiled some details on how it plans to reduce NHS waiting lists in England following what it called 14 years of damage done by the Conservatives. Tomorrow's budget will include more than £1.5 billion for new surgical hubs and radiotherapy machines. The Conservatives say they provided record funding for the NHS. Super-strength synthetic opioid drugs have been found in samples of fake medicines being bought by people in the UK. They were sold online, purporting to treat conditions such as anxiety and insomnia. The opioids, called nitazenes, can cause death even in tiny amounts. The presidential nominees Kamala Harris and Donald Trump have been appealing to voters in key swing states as a campaigning for the U.S. election enters its final week. Ms. Harris told workers at a factory in Michigan that her Republican rival was only interested in tax cuts for big corporations. In Georgia, Mr. Trump hit back at critics who'd labeled him authoritarian, insisting he wasn't a Nazi. The Election Commission in Georgia says it will recount some ballots following Saturday's disputed election. Thousands of opposition protesters rallied outside Parliament last night. The governing party, the Georgian Dream, has been accused of rigging the vote by the pro-Western opposition. And a group of archaeologists has discovered a huge ancient city buried underground in southeast Mexico. They found the Mayan city by using archaeology tools to study radar images of the area, which revealed pyramids, sports fields and amphitheatres.
Vijay, thank you very much. For the last 3 years, the family of Sir David Amess, who served as Southend's Conservative MP from 1982 until his murder during a constituency surgery in 2021, have been left with unanswered questions, as well as the horrifying circumstances of his death. The man who stabbed him more than 20 times had, when he was a teenager 5 years before, been referred to the anti-extremism prevent system. In the last 48 hours, the senior Essex coroner has revealed why the inquest is not being resumed. He said there was no evidential basis to consider that the attack was possibly preventable. I've been speaking to Sir David's daughter, Katie, who told me first about her father.
Well, he was the most hardest working person I've ever met. He absolutely lived for his job. Every waking second of the day, he wanted to be with his people, meeting them, helping them, talking to them. He was just so full of life and enigmatic and passionate.
Had you ever had any cause to worry about his safety?
I think on and off throughout the years, you know, you're always worried, but you would never imagine that somebody could so brazenly do this. The night before it happened to my dad, my brother received a phone call saying that my father was going to be killed. So he reported it to the police instantly. Obviously, you would presume, given that there was a death threat to a member of parliament, they would turn up at his surgery the next day to protect him.
The police, you mean?
Yes, the police should have turned up to protect him. The guy that killed my father admitted that he had gone to another surgery or, you know, other people's houses to kill them. And when he saw a police presence, he obviously didn't go through with the attack. Had the police have been there, we might not be sitting here today without my father.
But was that phone call to do with the man who then was your father's killer, Ali Harbi Ali?
Subsequently, the police say that they arrested people that made the phone call and it was not related. But that's just irrelevant to us because they should have gone still. Just one threat should be enough for you to go and protect somebody. If they were there, my dad probably wouldn't be dead. And I think we need to have a full investigation into why they didn't show up. And people need to know the answers to this, that we can prevent it happening again. The coroner released his reasonings for not reopening the inquest in the last couple of days and made that public. And in that report, he states that the police missed several opportunities to stop this guy doing a terrorist attack. He was reported by his head teacher in sixth form. Prevent met with him. And during the trial, he even said that he knew just to nod his head at the right points and just say he wasn't a terrorist. If you're a terrorist, you're not going to stand up and be like, I'm a terrorist. You're obviously going to say you're not. They missed follow-up meetings with him, so he was able to just disappear out of the system and was never followed up on. And had we have done the proper monitoring through this prevent scheme, we could have stopped this. And it's not just failed my family, it's failed other members of the public, and it's failing other members of parliament, because how do we know that this isn't going to happen again?
That coroner's report that you mention, I've been reading through it, and it essentially holds to his reasoning for not resuming the inquest into your father's murder. And the conclusion the coroner has come to is that while there were some shortcomings identified in the operation of the PREVENT programme, the coroner doesn't think there's any causative link between those shortcomings and the events of the 15th of October 2021, when your father was murdered. He thinks there was so much of a gap between the PREVENT intervention, which happened when this man was in his mid-teens, and what happened to your father, that he thinks there's no evidential basis to consider that the attack was possibly preventable so many years, and his word, imponderables later.
But that's completely ridiculous. What is the point of PREVENT then? The point of PREVENT is to track down terrorists and stop them before they carry out their attack. The police had a phone call the night before. Why on earth would they not go to the surgery the next day? There's so many people that are at fault here, and nobody is being given any answers because I'm not being allowed a full, public, open inquest so that we can learn from our mistakes and make sure this doesn't happen again. Why on earth would you not want an inquest into this? My father gave 40 years of his life serving his people day in, day out. He would be absolutely ashamed of the behaviour from senior members of the government who are not supporting me in this. Everybody was crying when he died and saying what a great man he was. Where are these people now helping to find out why he was let down by the government and by the police? He is owed the decency and the respect to find out what went wrong.
Now that you have this decision from the coroner that the investigation and the inquest is not being resumed, where does it leave you as a family? What are the remaining options that you can pursue?
There's absolutely no options, because it was widely reported that I had launched a civil claim against the government and the police. The only reason that I had to launch that civil claim is because the Home Office refused to let me have a standstill because the amount of time that had passed since my father's tragic death and us coming forward to say we wanted an inquest had expired. The Home Office said they would refuse to make an exception. My mother had a stroke after it happened, so she wasn't in the right physical or mental state of mind to be able to fight for my dad. So I can't actually do the civil claim because that would cost like hundreds of thousands of pounds that obviously I don't have. So my only hope was to do this inquest, and that has been taken from me. So I think they just expect me to disappear and just think, oh, don't, never mind, let's just carry on. But I'm not going to do that. I'm going to stand up for what is right. We live in a democracy. Somebody needs to say this is not right, and we need an investigation, we need answers, and we need to prevent this ever happening to somebody else again. Because I'm telling you right now, this will not be the only attack. Jo Cox and her poor family, that happened only a few years before my dad. We can prevent this, not through the PREVENT scheme, because clearly that isn't working, but through a public open inquest where we can find out who went wrong. I was told that it was an admin error that meant that the guy, he wasn't forced to follow up with subsequent meetings and his paperwork was never passed on, and then they just closed the case. That is not an acceptable admin error. We have a lot of questions and somebody needs to answer them.
You're speaking to us from Southend, which is now a city. It gained that status in tribute to your father. It's been 3 years. Yeah. How or where are the places around you where you particularly think of him and imagine him being and still serving as the MP?
For me, it's so hard to be in Southend because it just reminds me of my father everywhere I go. He loved this place so much, and everywhere I look is just memories of him. I just wish that he was here to see all of this and to see Southend as a city.
Katie Amos, daughter of Sir David Amos, thank you.
Thank you.
We did approach Essex Police about Katie Amos's view that they should have been at her father's surgery after the threat in a phone call to her brother. They told us they began investigating immediately after being notified at 9 p.m. on the 14th of October. That's the day before the murder, and a man and a woman were arrested. They said in a statement, "This incident and the murder of Sir David were not linked in any way, and the people arrested and the person the threat was made directly to were known to each other. None were connected to Ali Harbi Ali." In the immediate aftermath of Sir David's murder, they say two of our heroic unarmed officers ran into the face of danger, trying desperately to save him and, of course, detaining his killer. Officers then worked with paramedic colleagues to help save Sir David. Sadly, they were unable to do this.
It's 18 minutes to 8. Now, thinking about where we are in the calendar and Halloween fast approaching, if that's your thing. We have been thumbing through spooky stories for our children's book club this week, of course with half term as well. Danny Robbins has sent us his suggestions on the theme of Halloween.
Hello, this is Danny Robbins from the Radio 4 podcast Uncanny, and I would like to recommend two spooky books this Halloween. The first is a book that inspired me a lot when I was a kid and made me want to study ghosts more. Osborne's World of the Unknown, Ghosts. It's a great book. It's been reissued recently for foreword by Rhys Shearsmith from The League of Gentlemen and Inside Number 9. But I think I've still got a copy of the original from a long, long time ago. It was probably old even by the time I had it as a kid. And it's just this brilliant picture book full of things about the study of ghosts, famous cases and possible causes, skeptic and otherwise. And yeah, it really inspired me and still inspires me to this day, actually. And I think it's what inspired a lot of people my age to be fascinated by the paranormal. The other book I'd like to recommend is another picture book, actually, and it's a pop-up book. It's Haunted House by Jan Pienkowski, who did the Megan Mogg books, amongst other things as well. And it's just this great, lovely, three-dimensional look at a haunted house, a fictional haunted house, with spooky bats, giant bats in the attic, gorillas lurking behind sofas and skeletons jumping out of closets. It's great. It's what any pop-up book should be. Fun, funny, a little bit spooky, and very in your face. They pop up right out at you. So, yeah, those are my two tips, two books I loved as a spooky kid and that I would recommend to any spooky kids out there. Happy Halloween.
Sounds good for tired parents too. Things popping out of books at bedtime for me really helps at the moment. You can suggest Halloween half-term spooky books, your suggestions on WhatsApp 0330 123 4346.
It is 7:45, time for Thought for the Day, and our speaker this morning is the writer and Catholic theologian, Tina Beattie.
Good morning. This weekend saw the end of a three-year process of consultation in the Catholic Church, which sought feedback from Catholics around the world on a variety of issues. One topic proposed for discussion was the ordination of women as deacons. An international survey of 17,000 Catholic women submitted to the Vatican found that the majority of respondents supported women's ordination. However, the role of women in the Church remains highly divisive, with conservatives insisting there's no theological justification for ordaining women. The discussion was sidelined, as it has been several times before. I share the disappointment of those who had hoped for a more open dialogue, but despite my frustrations, I remain within this vast community of prayer, worship and theology, for it extends far beyond institutional Catholicism. Like all great religious traditions, the Catholic Church is a custodian of living stories and expressions of yearning and hope that speak to the human condition. For me, there's a creative tension between the opportunities and challenges of modern society, including feminism, and enduring sources of meaning rooted in historical communities of faith. The Catholic magazine The Tablet has an interview this week with psychiatrist and philosopher Ian McGilchrist. He's an influential critic of modern Western society on the basis of his theory that modernity has privileged the mechanistic, practical and self-interested left hemisphere of the brain while neglecting the values of imagination, creativity and generosity associated with the right hemisphere. As a result, he argues, we've cut ourselves off from sustaining networks of connection with nature, with the divine, and with one another, and we're losing our sense of wonder and our capacity for humility. McGilchrist is one of several thinkers who have turned to the Christian tradition in the quest to make sense of the failures and sorrows of our turbulent times. Others include historian Tom Holland and singer-songwriter Nick Cave. I'm inspired by such thinkers who, while not identifying with the institutional church, are breaking open the tradition and affirming Christianity's capacity to nurture a sense of meaning, earthed in wonder and sustained by hope. In the Gospels, Jesus warns his disciples that new wine cannot be put into old wineskins because they'll burst. Perhaps the old wineskins of Christian institutions are being burst open by new wine fermenting on the margins, where many of us are seeking a path of wisdom through the tangled relationship between modernity's aspirations and Christian inspiration.
That was Thought for the Day with Tina Beattie. It's 12 minutes to 8. Protesters outside abortion clinics standing with signs, sometimes featuring graphic images, holding leaflets and often rosary beads, have become the norm. Worryingly and upsettingly so for some of the women going in for their procedure, who are sometimes accosted by these individuals too. The same is true for healthcare staff working at these clinics. Other protesters stand, silently mouthing prayers. From this Thursday, a new law will come into effect in England and Wales that will make it illegal to influence, harass or provoke anyone using or administering pregnancy termination services within a 150-metre radius of the building. That also includes those silently praying. Abortion buffer zones have long been campaigned for by some and fought against by others. Those who break this new law will face a fine of an unlimited amount. The hope is to put stronger safeguards for women accessing this health service in place, especially at a time when the topic of abortion is aggressively debated globally. The change follows similar bans already implemented in Northern Ireland that happened last year and in Scotland of September of this year. Well, yesterday I visited an abortion clinic in South London, the entrances to which were flanked by two men praying and hoping to stop women going ahead with their abortions. Ahead of this law coming in on Thursday, we're standing outside an abortion provider, MSI Reproductive Choice. It's formerly known as Mary Stopes. It's one of the largest abortion providers in the UK. You probably wouldn't notice it if you didn't know about it. But what is a current feature of this particular clinic, and actually somehow what makes it stand out more, is the fact that there are always pretty much protesters outside it. It's a place I've walked past a lot, and strikingly, it's set on a main road, even though it's set back. So you'd have to walk past one guy who looks like he's giving out rosary beads to go in if you're a woman today. But if perhaps you were crossing at the lights, you would see that some of those are standing there with signs. Let's go and speak to some of the protesters if we can. Hello, my name's Emma. I work at the BBC. Are you praying? Yes, you are praying. I'm sorry to interrupt. I just thought you might be able to stop for a moment and talk. Why can you not stop? No, I will. I will. So they don't want to talk, which I'm going to respect the fact they're standing here praying. The sign says, pregnant, need help, housing help, financial support, moral support, ask here. And then on the easel is a print of a painting of Mary. I will go across the street and speak to the two men who are flanking either side of the gate. What's your name?
Richard.
How long have you been coming to stand outside this place?
About 5 weeks. So we're a Catholic charity who provide the right sort of counselling that pregnant women need in all situations, but especially crisis pregnancies.
And why do you feel so strongly to be an intern and to stand here?
Because we have the privilege to be able to speak because we're human beings. And there's so many people every day who will never have that ability because they are killed before they're even in the world outside of their mother's womb.
Do you believe in any circumstance in which abortion is okay?
Never.
If a woman is raped and harmed by a man, do you believe she can have a baby that she did not consent to having the sex to create?
There's an awful lot of women who regret having abortions, including in tragic circumstances of rape or incest. They are dreadful, and the perpetrators need to be punished, and the woman needs to be protected as well. And we need to provide as much compassion. We need to weep with her and be empathetic to her and show her that...
Well, empathy won't pay the bills or deal with the fact that you will be able to see your rapist's face on your baby's face and could be even more re-traumatising.
An abortion is traumatic for the woman.
How do you know that as a man?
Well, there's been studies that demonstrate it. You don't need to be of a particular sex to know about the other sex.
Will you come when the law changes? Will you still stand outside the 150-metre perimeter being extended from Thursday in England and Wales?
I'll see what the policy of the of different organisations are and what my supervisors say.
Just finally, for those women who say they are intimidated by your presence, not you personally, but the presence of people who are of a similar view and take this action, what would you say to them who think it's cruel and quite intimidating to have you standing here as a man when they go in potentially for an abortion or for advice?
I think those perceptions come from certain images, perhaps not from Britain. We don't intimidate people here. We're not an aggressive people.
We've just finished talking to the protesters on either side of the gate, walked through the gate, through a car park, which is actually surrounded by trees, to a bricks building with two bright blue doors, and we're going to go in and speak to one of the women who works there.
So I'm Ailish McEntee. I'm the named midwife for safeguarding adults and children at MSI Reproductive Choices.
What can you say you have seen, and do the women, some of the women, the patients themselves, do they tell you what has happened?
Yeah, so they will come up to anyone that they see walking into clinic. They will offer rosary beads, they'll offer to pray for you, they'll try and get you to change your mind, and they'll say quite inflammatory things. Women have had people screaming murderer or shouting out mummy, and, you know, saying that they're going to be praying for them, and that is a kind of really harrowing experience. I was speaking to the clinical manager here, and she had a woman recently that came in after having been approached by these anti-choice protesters, and it took an hour to kind of calm her down to the point where she was then able to actually continue with her consultation and kind of do the next steps in terms of treatment. And so it's not necessary for someone to be made to feel like that when they're coming for a medical appointment.
What would you say to those who feel uncomfortable about a buffer zone? You know, maybe they're not quite familiar, they're listening to this, they're not quite familiar with the landscape of this particular site or any of the other sites that... We're a free country, we believe in free speech, we also, as some would say it and have described it, but I recognise there are other people who behave differently, standing and silently praying, holding a rosary bead. Do you have any sympathy for that?
I think the main point here is that absolutely we support the right to free speech. The buffer zone just means that that is going to have to happen 150 metres away from the clinic. And so it takes away the element of them being able to, you know, potentially intimidate and harass the people that are coming in for treatment for us.
We've just left the abortion clinic and headed to Westminster to meet Labour MP for Walthamstow, Stella Creasy, a big supporter of this law coming in. How do you see this working? Tell us a bit more about the enforcement of this.
So we actually already have a model for the enforcement of all of this, because for many years, some local authorities have had what's called a public space protection order, and they've used that to deal with this challenge. The problem with public space protection orders is it requires you to prove that women have been harassed first before you can intervene, which means that you put a huge burden on women who are at a point in their lives where probably the last thing they want to be doing is talking to a local council about how they feel to give evidence. It won't rely on women to have to say, I feel I've been harassed. It will take it as given that these are not appropriate spaces in which to protest. So if you do that, you are breaching the safe access zone, and in which case that is a criminal offence. What I would also expect, so that we're clear about it, is that the police will intervene.
What do you make of those, some of those who oppose this law, who talked about their human rights being breached? So the idea that in the Human Rights Act, that their right to religion, to consciousness, to thought, to faith, that has been contravened by this law.
Those rights are absolutely being upheld by this law, because absolutely we must defend the right of people to be able to pray, but you don't have a human right to pray outside an abortion clinic.
You yourself have had some personal experience of harassment on this front. Can you remind our listeners what happened to you and what has happened with that? Has it been looked into?
No, it hasn't. And indeed, there is a gentleman who told my four-year-old child that I was a child killer and caused her huge distress in the street, that the police have protected that as a form of freedom of speech. I think there is a blind spot when it comes to issues like abortion in this country and applying the other forms of public order law around harassment. And I think that is a debate we need to have. It's a good day that we've got safe access zones, because it does balance a right to debate and discuss abortion with a right to have one. But if people think that's the only thing we need to do to protect a woman's right to choose in England and Wales, they haven't been paying attention.
Labour MP Stella Creasy there, and the discussion and insights around the new law to put buffer zones around England and Wales's abortion clinics that will come into effect from this Thursday.
Join Americast on the road to the US election.
It's the BBC podcast full of lively chats about politics,
with social media investigations
and experts on the ground.
We'll guide you through all the key moments as the United States chooses which direction to go in next.
Navigate your way to Election Day and beyond.
Americast.
Listen on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Look forward to listening to more and more of that. Now for the weather forecast, here's Sarah Keith Lucas.
Thanks, Emma. Well, we've got a big area of high pressure in charge of our weather, so that's bringing a really quiet spell of weather through today and the rest of the week. Things really not changing in a hurry, but most of us are going to see a lot of cloud in the skies. There'll be some sunshine developing today, and it's still reasonably mild for the time of year. So if you're across all of southern England, through the Midlands, eastern England, Wales and northwest England, expect a fairly grey, murky sort of day. There's the odd spot of drizzle coming out of that cloud, and this morning that's across Wales, northwest England, the Midlands, the far southeast of England, also seen a bit of drizzle. But it's easing, we could see the odd spot lingering into the afternoon, but most places turning a little bit brighter, some glimpses of blue sky along the south coast, through parts of Wales as well, and temperatures 15 or 16 degrees with light winds too. If you're across the northeast of England and eastern Scotland, it's here that we will see more sunshine around. So some brighter skies developing, still a little bit of cloud around here and there. 15, 16 degrees, and some morning mist will slowly clear its way further north. For Northern Ireland, southwest Scotland and northern Scotland, here it stays pretty cloudy through the day, but mostly dry. There'll be a little bit more sunshine working into the far north of Scotland, in fact, later on into the afternoon. But temperatures in the far north are 11 or 12 degrees, for the rest of the region around 14. Overnight tonight, things staying largely dry. Like last night, there'll be some pockets of mist and fog around, and it's still mild. Into tomorrow, another largely dry, if somewhat cloudier day, but some sunshine developing later on tomorrow.
Sarah, thank you very much. You're listening to Today.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 29th of October. The headlines today. The UK, US and Germany have expressed grave concern about Israel's decision to ban the UN's main relief agency for Palestinians. Ministers have revealed that tomorrow's budget will include more than £1 billion worth of investment in equipment for the NHS. After the news, we'll be joined by the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting. Deadly super-strength opioids have been found in fake medicines being sold online to people in the UK.
Coming up before nine, the Turner Prize nominated artist David Shrigley will talk to us about taking a 9 metre high sculpture into his old school. It's part of his effort to make everyone understand the importance of the arts in education. And
so when I saw this manuscript, I had a feeling of sort of cautious excitement. Perhaps, you know, if this is what I think it is, I might be one of the first people in modern times to hear this melody.
We'll be talking about the discovery of a lost Chopin waltz in a New York library and how the music has been played by Lang Lang. The BBC News is read by Vigi Alice.
Israel's allies have condemned a decision by the Israeli parliament to ban the UN's Palestinian Refugee Agency from working within the country, warning that it plays a critical role in delivering humanitarian assistance to Gaza. Israel has accused UNRWA staff of involvement in the 7th of October attacks and diverting aid in Gaza. Sir Keir Starmer said he was gravely concerned about the ban. Our Middle East correspondent Yolande Nell reports from Jerusalem.
Despite widespread international opposition, Israeli MPs voted overwhelmingly to approve two bills. These essentially bar UNRWA from operating in Israel and annexed East Jerusalem and severely curtail its ability to work in the occupied West Bank and Gaza, where it's the largest UN agency playing a vital role in distributing aid and running wartime shelters. The UNRWA spokeswoman Julia Tuma says the legislation breaches the UN Charter and Israel's obligations under international law.
The vote by the Israeli parliament is unprecedented. It's a threat to our common humanity. It's time to allow us to do our work. Just allow us to do our work. Enough. Enough.
Israeli officials accuse UNRWA of being complicit with Hamas and cite the involvement of a handful of its thousands of staff in the 7th of October attacks. The agency insists it's impartial. Responding to the new laws, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres insisted that UNRWA is indispensable.
Officials in Gaza say at least 55 people have been killed in an Israeli airstrike on a residential building in the town of Beit Lahia in the north of the territory. The Palestinian Civil Emergency Service says many victims are believed to be trapped under rubble. Israel has not commented. The government has announced some details of its plan to fix what it is calling 14 years of damage done to the NHS by the Conservatives, including £1.5 billion of investment in equipment and buildings. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, said the move would help to arrest the decline in the health service, but warned there could still be patients waiting on trolleys and in corridors this winter. The Conservatives say they delivered record funding for the NHS. Here's our health editor, Hugh Pym.
For the first time, the government has set out some of its detailed thinking on how to reduce England's waiting list of 7.64 million. The Treasury says £1.8 billion of extra money has been provided to the NHS since the election for more operations and appointments. There'll be £1.57 billion allocated next year for equipment including scanners and radiotherapy machines. The extra money announced by Westminster will also lead to increased budgets in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. These are some but not all of the government's plans for the NHS. The budget will reveal the overall spending numbers and how these compare with the trend in previous years.
Saffron Caudry is the Deputy Chief Executive of NHS Providers, which represents hospitals, mental health community and ambulance services in England. She told us the new investment was really welcome, but said much more was needed to address what she called significant financial challenges.
This starts the process of rebuilding the NHS and investing in the capital that the NHS needs. But I think it's worth saying that this is a really long-term endeavour, and we need to think about not just the investment in capital, but also the running costs that go with that investment in capital. The two need to go hand in hand.
Super-strength synthetic opioid drugs, which have been linked to hundreds of deaths, have been found in samples of fake medicines in the UK. They were sold online, purporting to treat conditions such as anxiety and insomnia. The opioids, called nitazenes, can be stronger than heroin, and even a tiny amount can lead to a fatal overdose. Our correspondent Navthej Johal reports.
It's believed nitazenes are being made in illicit labs in China and are arriving in the UK by post. They'd been found previously in many heroin samples. But BBC analysis of data from the National Drug Testing Service, WEDINOS, shows nitazenes were detected 130 times in the 12 months to September in contaminated medicines sent in anonymously after being bought online. An expert in illicit synthetic drugs from the United Nations, Martin Reitelhuber, says the BBC's findings mirror the start of the opioid crisis in the United States.
There's a lesson to learn from North America, where the expansion of the opioid crisis was driven by populations consuming prescription medicines. So here in Europe, we are not yet in that situation, but this could be the early signs.
15 synthetic opioids have been banned in the UK this year, and there are proposals to outlaw more. But experts are calling for urgent action, including more drug testing.
Kamala Harris and Donald Trump have been appealing to voters in key swing states as campaigning for the U.S. election enters its final week. Ms. Harris told workers at a factory in Michigan that her Republican rival was only interested in tax cuts for big corporations. In Georgia, Mr. Trump hit back at critics who'd labeled him authoritarian, insisting he wasn't a Nazi. Georgia's Central Election Commission has announced it will conduct recounts of ballots from randomly selected polling stations after reports of widespread violations in Saturday's vote, including interference by Russia. The pro-Western opposition has accused the governing party, Georgian Dream, of unprecedented election fraud. Rehan Dimitri reports from Tbilisi.
A statement on the Central Election Commission's website says that district election commissions will recount ballots from five polling stations randomly selected in each election area. Earlier, a local observer mission said that violations were systematic and called for the results from nearly 200 electoral polling stations to be overturned. The opposition has declared last week's parliamentary election illegitimate and has demanded a new election under international supervision. Thousands of Georgians gathered outside parliament last night to denounce the results as stolen. The Georgian government has rejected allegations of vote rigging. It has not responded to the opposition's demands.
Data obtained by the BBC shows that young people in England who need support for their mental health are having to wait more than twice as long for treatment as they did 4 years ago. On average, each young person is having to wait 315 days for treatment on the NHS. Newsbeat's Eleanor Sherwood reports.
At the end of March 2021, 18 to 24-year-olds waited on average 140 days for mental health treatment without being seen. BBC Newsbeat's found not only has that period more than doubled in the past 4 years, but the number in that queue's also gone up by 57% to more than 200,000. Those waiting have told us it's heartbreaking and makes them feel as if they need to get worse before they can receive help. NHS England says improving access to mental health services is a key priority. It says it's expanding services as quickly as possible by allowing those who can't access a GP to self-refer online and introducing an extra 40,000 mental health staff.
The mother of the British rugby player Levi Davis, who went missing in Barcelona 2 years ago, is calling for an inquiry led by UK police into his disappearance. A 14-month investigation by the newspaper Byline Times has identified multiple failings by police in Spain. Rachel Stonehouse reports.
Levi Davis played professional rugby, including for a period at the Premiership club Bath. He also appeared on Celebrity X Factor. But he disappeared in 2022, hours after arriving in Barcelona by ferry from Ibiza. Authorities said at the time they were looking into the possibility he drowned and closed the case. But his family now say the Spanish police failed to investigate his disappearance properly and are calling for a UK-led inquiry. The police in Barcelona have told the BBC they're waiting to hear from the courts whether there will be another investigation. This comes as the independent publication Byline Times reports there have been multiple failings by officers, including not getting CCTV or Levi Davis's communications history. The news site has also been looking into whether Levi might have been blackmailed and want the case to be looked at more thoroughly.
The funeral of the former First Minister of Scotland, Alex Salmond, will take place in Aberdeenshire today. He died earlier this month while attending a conference in North Macedonia. Family and close friends of Mr. Salmond will attend a private service at Stricken Parish Church. A public memorial is expected to be held in the coming weeks. A group of PhD students has discovered a huge ancient city underground in southeast Mexico. The city, which has been named Valeriana, is thought to have been home to up to 50,000 people in the 9th century. The researchers identified thousands of structures, including pyramids, sports fields and amphitheatres. Professor Elizabeth Graham of University College London is an expert in Mayan civilization and isn't surprised it went undiscovered for so long.
I don't know if you've ever walked through the forest, but you can miss structures easily. You know, you might not miss a structure that's, 31 meters high, but or you might know it's there, like the locals, and not comment on it.
Professor Elizabeth Graham.
Fiji, thank you very much. The time is 10 past eight. The budget will include new spending on health. We know that because some details have been released today. They relate to England and include £1.5 billion to be spent on equipment and buildings next year. The context is an annual budget of around £180 billion. And the decision will also lead to increased budget for the health service in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. NHS providers, whose members include hospitals and other organisations across the NHS, told us that while the money is welcome, much more is needed to address what they called the significant financial challenges of the NHS. And we're joined from our Westminster studio by the Health and Social Care Secretary, Wes Streeting. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Can you say today that the money that will be allocated in the budget tomorrow will improve the NHS significantly?
Yes, in fact, we are setting out today that the budget will enable us to deliver our manifesto commitments on 40,000 more appointments every week to cut waiting lists, and not just more appointments, but reformed ways of working. In fact, thanks to the Chancellor, I've been able to start that work already in the weeks that followed the general election. We are going to deliver on our commitment to double the number of diagnostic scanners over the course of this parliament, so we can not only diagnose earlier and treat faster, better for patients, better for taxpayers. We will also be able to deploy AI-enabled scanners, which improve quality, speed and productivity within diagnostics, which account for a significant proportion of the waiting list, about 1.5 million people waiting for diagnostic checks and scans. So this is good news for the NHS. We will arrest the decline, start turning the ship around. Can we solve all of the problems in the NHS in a single budget or a single year? Of course not. I think people know that it takes time.
That's why we've wasted no time in getting started. At the beginning, I said, were you confident that the money would improve the NHS significantly? And you said, yes, you are. So that's the promise ahead of tomorrow.
Well, what the Chancellor's doing is setting us up to deliver the key goal we've set ourselves for this Parliament, which is to return waiting times to the 18-week standard from referral to treatment that the NHS Constitution says that patients should receive and has not been met for some years.
Well, fix the NHS is the big promise, isn't it?
Yeah, of course. And I think people are realistic. You don't fix the NHS overnight. You don't fix it in a single budget. But over the course of this parliament, we will get the NHS back on its feet at the same time as making the right long-term decisions that will make the NHS fit for the future, which is why we've taken immediate steps since the general election on things like resolving the junior doctor strikes and building a new relationship with resident doctors, or the 1,000 more GPs we are funding to get onto the front line in the coming weeks and months.
Yeah. Well, the waiting lists are rising, aren't they, in the same period, which again shows us how serious and pressing the challenge is.
That's right. And you will not find me at any point during my tenure as Health and Social Care Secretary pretending that even as we are making progress, that there aren't still significant challenges. I will always face up to the challenges. I will not duck the difficult decisions or the fact that there are still problems to be solved. And you will see me on the front line this winter where there will still be challenges, because you can't just wave away the pressures of winter.
Right, but you can make choices, can't you? And one of the serious problems facing the NHS is social care, and the problems in social care and the lack of funding of social care to the extent that matches demand. Is there going to be an investment in social care announced tomorrow?
Well, I definitely don't want to be on the wrong end of the Speaker, or indeed the wrong end of the Chancellor, by announcing her budget a day ahead of time. You can wait until tomorrow for the budget.
Okay, but if there isn't, that affects the whole performance of the NHS, doesn't it?
Well, I would just say, well, certainly there's no answer to the NHS that doesn't involve social care and dealing with delayed discharges. I would also argue very strongly that social care is important in and of itself for older people and disabled people who rely on good quality social care to lead full, active, independent lives. And I would also say that, as with the NHS, that we need a serious 10-year plan for social care. But just last week, we had in front of Parliament, in front of the House of Commons, the Employment Rights Bill, which will deliver the first ever fair pay agreements for social care workers to build a social care profession as part of a national care service. So we are already taking action. Of course, it takes time to turn around the scale of the challenge we see in our country, whether in health, social care, any of our public services, the state of our public finances, or indeed the state of trust in politics. Change will take time, but we've wasted no time in recent weeks.
If you don't make a serious start on investment in social care tomorrow, it could well impede your ability to get to a significant point by the one-year anniversary of the election, which is to have 40,000 new hospital appointments and procedures every week.
Well, as I'm thinking about the pressures in particularly urgent and emergency care and delayed discharge in hospital, we have to make sure that social care is part of the answer there. We are also thinking about, as we build the long-term plan for social care, how best to create a degree of national consensus around a national care service in a way that we have done over the last 76 years with the National Health Service, which is not to say that there aren't differences in performance or policy between the political parties.
That sounds a bit like kicking the can down the road. You'll remember the Dilnot report. We've had years of when parties haven't wanted to really have the decisions, take responsibility for the decisions themselves. They always talk about cross-party consensus, and we've had an attempt at that. That's what the Dilnot report was all about.
Well, we can relitigate the arguments after the general election about the fact that Conservatives promised a care cap but hadn't left the funding there and hadn't even put in place the operational changes to introduce the care cap when they promised. I do think it is a good thing and a good and noble intention to try and build a genuine national consensus around a national care service so you don't get public policy, you know, roaming around like a shopping trolley from one government to the next, from one party to the next. That's broadly where we've been on the NHS for the last 76 years. And even though the Conservatives voted against its foundation 22 times, they've never dared to undo the NHS ultimately because the national consensus was so strong. I would like to do the same on social care. And what has actually been encouraging on a note of cross-party conciliation, which has been noticeably absent in our politics for some years. Since the general election, I've had the Conservative Party, the Liberal Democrats and Reform all saying they would like to work on a cross-party basis. And we are thinking very carefully at the moment about how best to do that. Okay. I think we've all got some blame and responsibility to bear for the state of social care. This has plagued successive government, Labour, Conservative, Liberal Democrat and SNP. I think it would be a good thing for our politics and for social care if the parties that were part of creating the problem might actually come together to provide the solution.
How aware are you of the worries among charities who make a difference in the NHS and in social care, whether it's a charity like Nugent, which works in social care in Liverpool, or a charity like Marie Curie, which helps people and families at the end of life stage, that they are not going to be protected from the increase in employer national insurance contributions?
It's a difficult time for the voluntary sector, and indeed a difficult time for the private sector and for the public sector. The Chancellor will set out all of her decisions tomorrow, and I think people then will see the full extent of the choices and trade-offs we are having to make to stabilise the public finances, to fix the foundations of our economy, and make sure that we are not stuck in this doom loop. Yep. Of low growth, low productivity,
high tax, and a high exactly price those of words failure. Yesterday, I do want to just get you to address what we are hearing, which are, you know, very serious problems from charities like Marie Curie. We will now need to ask for more funding from our NHS partners or rely further on kind donations from the public to continue to provide our services. That's because they fear that if they are subject to employers' national insurance contributions, that's going to have a detrimental impact on the amount of care they can provide. You do recognise how difficult their budgets already are and the impact that having to pay more in employer national insurance contributions would have.
Well, I'm not going to speculate on something that the Chancellor hasn't announced.
Are you sympathetic to them?
Wait for her budget tomorrow and then people can see the full range of measures in the round and judge all of the choices and trade-offs that we are having to make. Unless we take the difficult decisions now to fix the foundations of the public finances, we will end up paying a much heavier price of failure. That isn't a hypothetical assertion. We have seen this movie before. When the Conservatives pretended...
I'm talking about not-for-profit organisations. Are you sympathetic to charities?
There's a fundamental point here about difficult choices that need to be made now.
So the charities need to make difficult choices
too? No, you are asking me again to indulge in speculation ahead of the budget, which I've said I am not going to be able to do.
Are you sympathetic to these charities like Marie Curie?
Well, I'm always sympathetic to charities. They do a great job. But I'm making a fundamental argument here, which is about the choices and the trade-offs that we are having to make to fix the foundations of the public finances now, or else we all pay a higher price for failure. We are still paying a high price of failure for a mini budget that pretended that you could spend recklessly without having to balance the books. We are not going to repeat those mistakes. That's why this government isn't ducking the difficult decisions. We will face up to the hard choices. We will take all of the knocks and criticisms that inevitably follow when you take those hard choices. But the country will thank us in a long run if we leave this country in a better place than we found it, which is something the last Labour government was able to say after 13 years. This Labour government will be able to say at the end of our time, and the Conservatives could not say after 14 years, because they can barely point to a single achievement, having wrecked the economy, wrecked our public services and destroyed trust in politics.
Let's talk about events further afield, but to which we are connected because your government made the decision to restore funding to UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. Sir Keir Starmer says he's gravely concerned by the decision Israeli lawmakers have made to ban it, and says it makes UNRWA's essential work for Palestinians impossible, jeopardising the entire international humanitarian response in Gaza. Is the government pushing Israel to reverse this decision? And if so, how?
Of course we are. And so are our, many of our international allies. Look, this is a catastrophe for humanitarian relief. We are already seeing the consequences of this war in terms of the humanitarian crisis and the fact that we struggle to get in to vaccinate against conditions like polio. It is a dire and frankly, if you haven't seen it, and I've had colleagues who have been and seen firsthand the scale of the catastrophe for the Palestinians, this is a disaster. And I would urge, and the government is urging, Israel to reconsider, to really reflect on the way it's conducting this war.
Is the government calling the ambassador in about it?
Those decisions in terms of next steps are for the foreign secretary and the prime minister to set out. It's not for me to jump ahead of them. I think what you have seen...
If you think it's a catastrophe, what levers is the government pulling to try and get Israel to reverse it?
Well, what you have seen in recent months from the Prime Minister, the Foreign Secretary, the Defence Secretary and the International Development Minister has been an incredibly energetic approach, shuttling back and forth to the Middle East, mobilising international allies to try and exercise restraint and stop the conflict we are already seeing
The
Middle East. Well, you say it hasn't worked. I mean, let's look at what's happened in relation to Israel and Lebanon, and indeed Israel and Iran. The objective of the international community has been to prevent full-scale war breaking out between Israel and Lebanon and Israel and Iran. And mercifully, so far, we haven't seen that take place. So let's not pretend that international diplomatic efforts and pressure isn't working. We are seeing some of that pressure coming to bear.
The provision of aid in Gaza is getting worse.
Unquestionably, and that's exactly what the Prime Minister said yesterday. In terms of next steps, of course, we'll be consulting with our partners, with our allies in the region and elsewhere in the world, to look at what we can do both to bring pressure to bear on Israel to do the right thing and to take steps collectively to get as much humanitarian aid and assistance to the Palestinian people as we possibly can against the backdrop of the decision that Israel's taken. In terms of specific steps and measures the Prime Minister and the Foreign Secretary will be taking, it's for them to announce, not for me.
Wes Streeting, thank you.
Thank you.
It's 24 minutes past eight. Let's turn our attention towards education. We've been talking a great deal in the earlier part of that interview, certainly about health. But if you wanted to encourage schools and the government, having just heard a member of the government, to prioritise the teaching of the arts, how would you go about it? Arm yourself with a giant 9-metre green praying mantis sculpture, perhaps, and then take it to your old school? Well, that's what the Turner Prize nominated artist David Shrigley has done. He's known for deploying humour to great effect. You may remember he collected 6,000 copies of Dan Brown's novel, The Da Vinci Code, after a Swansea charity shop had jokingly appealed for people to stop donating copies, recycling them, and then turning them last year into a new edition of George Orwell's 1984. Pulp Fiction indeed. David Shrigley joins me now, and we're speaking at a time, good morning, when enrolment in art subjects at GCSE level has fallen to a new low. That type of thinking perhaps you don't feel is going to be encouraged. David, good morning.
Good morning.
What has inspired this giant 9-metre praying mantis sculpture?
Well, art-wise, I guess it was a piece that was going to go perhaps in a museum or an art gallery. And for various reasons, that never quite panned out. So I figured I would put it somewhere else to have a different conversation. So a school seemed a great place to have it.
And it's back at your old school, is that right?
Yeah. So then I thought, why not my old school to have an opportunity to go back there? After 37 years, which is quite a long time.
Well, let's give a shout out. What's the name of the school?
Beecham College in Oadby, in the south of Leicester.
Okay, and they've had to house this for now. And you are trying to turn people's attention to what exactly when it comes to education?
Well, the piece is primarily a life model. It's part of a series of works that I've made, the previous ones being human forms, but this is an insect form. So it's an invitation for the students to draw primarily, but we've come up with a series, with a lesson plan for the 2 weeks that it's there, where we've integrated all subjects, science, technology, martial arts, yoga, as well as art subjects. And the idea behind that was to see the art department as perhaps a centre, and the artwork itself as a kind of muse to inspire people for learning as well as to create art, and to think about how art can be really very much embedded in the curriculum rather than a peripheral subject. So there's been talk in previously about STEM subjects, science, technology, engineering, maths, being at the core of education. But I guess the proposition I'm making is art is a really important part of a balanced education, and you can't separate it out. It's not a hobby subject. It's learning how to think creatively and giving students the opportunity to have agency, I guess, to follow their own path is really, really important.
So making education. Making STEM into STEAM, adding the A in
STEAM,
there.
Yeah, exactly. We want to make STEM into STEAM.
It's certainly got a lovely sound to it, that. But it's interesting about the agency point as well, because there are so few ways, if you think back to it, if you think of your subjects, the way you, it's not about the teaching necessarily, but as a young person, that you feel that you have some control of a way of expressing yourself when you are being taught how to do something in subjects.
Indeed, I think that if you asked an engineer, for example, what skills you need to be a good engineer, you need to be a problem solver, I guess. And part of that is about thinking, it's about creative thinking. So art subjects are really the only subjects that do that. And you have to have agency, you have to think for yourself.
But you do also, just on a practical point, have to have materials, and you have to have sort of the support around you in school. Are you concerned about the lack of children going towards the arts at the moment, the way the numbers look, and also, you know, what they've got to work with within schools sometimes?
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, from the get-go, GCSE art numbers have halved since 2010, which is quite alarming, really. And I think that focus has shifted away from art, which is problematic. I think this is day two of the project. Yesterday we had a great day of drawing and painting, and we had a yoga class in the school. But the teacher, who's an amazing teacher, Jo, shout out to her, we provided all the materials for the project, and she was like, wow, this is amazing. Can we really have all this stuff? And I'm like, well, of course you can. You know, it's only it's just paper and pens and paint and stuff. And that small intervention was illustrative of the fact that, you know, the budget is so tight for that art department. And this is quite a good school as well within the area. There are schools that are struggling far more than Beecham College.
Well, David, we're going to have to leave it there. You also mentioned martial arts as part of the programme, so it'd be interesting to see if anyone takes on the 9-metre green praying mantis sculpture. I hope they don't. I hope it stays intact. David Shrigley, good to have you on the programme. Thank you.
I need to look up a picture of this.
You do. It's wonderful.
Kathy has the sport now. Hi, Kathy.
Morning. Thank you very much. The name in the frame to become the new manager at Manchester United is Portugal's Ruben Amorim. The 39-year-old led Sporting to their first Portuguese league title in 19 years when he joined them in 2020, and they've become champions for a second time since then. Manchester United are looking for a replacement for Erik ten Hag, who was sacked yesterday. Well, someone who knows an awful lot about United, but from playing against them rather than playing for them, joins me in the studio, the former Arsenal and England defender, Martin Keown. See, I have read your book about the pronunciation of your name. I'll get to that hopefully in a minute. But just interested in your thoughts on Ruben Amorim, just how he might fit in at United, or what do they need in order to return to that kind of success?
Well, they need to very quickly get back to the culture, that winning culture they had for many years. It's on the outside looking in, it looks a real sad affair. Ten Hag was, it seemed obvious that they were going to sack him in the summer, and they gave him that stay of execution, and it's just got worse. And of course, lots of changes in various pockets of management above him. And now they've ultimately sacked the manager. So it's the start of a new beginning. If I'm in that dressing room and I'm a successful type of individual, I'm rubbing my hands together thinking, right, OK, let's create change. Let's make something happen. And you know, that club can turn around very quickly. But whoever's at the helm, it's a really important decision.
It's interesting that you think they can turn that around very quickly, because they've obviously struggled since Sir Alex Ferguson retired. That was 2013, that was. And Arsenal, your old club, you talk about Arsene Wenger a lot in your book, in your autobiography, On the Edge. Mikel Arteta came in, and he's only the second permanent manager since Wenger left in 2018. They've had quite a different formula there, and something that seems to have worked much more in terms of stability than what's been happening at Old Trafford.
Yes, to begin with, of course, Emery only lasted 18 months and you had Arsene Wenger for 22 years. Arteta now is coming in. We're coming up to 5 years, and that stability is paying off. The team has now got that kind of fighting spirit back. Of course, it's got to keep its discipline, getting that balance. Every good team has a bit of discipline problems now and again. We were guilty of that. It's about staying above that line, getting the right balance. And, you know, Arsenal, it's a good model, Arsenal, but they've not won anything really, other than an FA Cup. So, but they're certainly ahead of Manchester United right now.
You talk about discipline there. When Arsene Wenger came in, he really did change the regime of football, the culture of football, with diet and the lack of drinking, which is something you didn't do anyway. But how much of a difference was that in the dressing room, and something that you talk about in the book?
Well, when I first came into the game, if you didn't drink alcohol, you were kind of like in the minority, and it was a little bit tricky.
This is the 80s, 90s.
Well, my father sent me to London with a clear message of not to drink alcohol, not to discuss religion, not to gamble. I didn't realise within 2 or 3 days all of those would come into action. People were homesick. We were 15 years of age, moving to London. You look at it now and you look at your own children, you think, wow, that was really very young. So I had that kind of education from my family, and it put me in good stead. Some of the other guys, well documented, the likes of Tony Adams, Paul Merson, had a difficult road. It's quite tricky to handle all the success that comes your way, the adulation, it's almost addictive after the games, everybody patting you on the back and following you around the West End of London, telling you, you're this great guy. I didn't
Before
go.
We had mobile phones where I would take a photo of you.
Well, I didn't go in that direction. I just, I thought it was a bit of a phony world. So I went a different direction. That's what I want to talk about a little bit, how I tried to fit in. I was always a little bit of the outsider, because from Oxford it was, where's your combine harvester every time I opened my mouth. So a thing called banter in London, which we didn't have in sleepy Oxford. So, that journey, I kind of climbed the mountain as a young player, 19 years of age in the Arsenal first team, and I jumped off that mountain.
You talked about what your father had said to you. You've written this book partly because your mum has Alzheimer's, and you're concerned about having headed the ball so much. You were a very combative player. Was that part of the reason you wanted to get this written down?
My two lads said, Dad, you've got loads of tales, loads of stories. We need to tell them. And of course, the position I play in, you're kind of 5 times more likely to get dementia. I kind of look at it now and think, at the time I was almost offended when I didn't win the ball if the keeper kicked it forward, and now I'm pleased that I didn't win every ball, because it maybe gives me a bit more time with my family, my loved ones. We don't know what's ahead of us.
Have you checked?
I have actually signed up to the PFA program. I went along 3 months ago, and I've passed all the cognitive testing. There's no damage, remarkably. So I'm just, you know, you plow on. But it's not something you, I think you have to be aware of it. It's sensible for your health to keep an eye on that. But it can't be at the forefront of my mind. And I'm leading my life. I'm living my life. And that's the most important thing.
And you were quite combative as a player. The title of the book is On the Edge. Was that just from the pitch or was that from childhood as well?
I'm looking at these nice ladies opposite me thinking they've got no idea, have they?
We're not nice.
Emma and Michelle, yeah. You've been called nice
Emma,
before.
You're out of order. I was very aggressive and I didn't stand on ceremony to be photographed. I look at some of the pictures and I think, wow, you know, could have smiled occasionally. I only really smiled when we won a trophy. And it's a story of really that unravelling the coil of the quality that I had. And it was only Arsene Wenger who was able to help me unravel that. And then, of course, it just took off.
Yeah.
But I was pretty blessed to be able to play with some of the best players that I've ever played the game. And I felt like I was kicking and screaming when I got dragged away, nearly 38, 39, thinking, oh, really, these guys are fantastic and I've got to jump off now, this journey that we're on. It felt hard to take.
Yeah, I'm scared to interrupt you now. Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming in to talk to us about On the Edge and about Manchester United, Martin Keown, as it is pronounced, as
pleasure.
We now know.
Well done with the pronunciation.
Yeah, Martin, first time I have been called nice, so I'm appreciating that. No, I'm joking. It's interesting to think about, lots in there. But coming up, giving you more to think about on Radio 4 in the next half an hour when we finish.
Hi, I'm Christy Young, and today on Young Again, I'm in conversation with the activist and writer Gloria Steinem, looking back on a career that spans 7 decades and wondering what advice she wishes she'd had when she was younger.
It's going to be all right. I don't know what's going to be, but it's going to be all right. I didn't at the time understand that there were so many different choices and so many different possibilities.
Hear that conversation at 9 a.m. on Young Again on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
The weather today, it is going to be largely cloudy with some drizzle and some sunny spells.
Beautifully done. Making us feel a bit better about some of the drizzle with the sun. You're listening to today on Radio 4 with Michelle Hussein and Emma Barnett. It's 23 minutes to 9 and now a summary of the news from Vijay Ellis.
Israel's allies, including the UK and the US, have condemned a parliamentary vote banning the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees from operating in the country. Israel has accused some staff from UNRWA of being involved in the 7th of October attacks. The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said the new law would have devastating consequences. Hamas officials in Gaza say an Israeli airstrike has killed at least 55 people in the northern town of Beit Lahia. The attack hit a 5-story residential building. Doctors say many of the dead were women and children. 20 people who were left injured have been taken to a nearby hospital as emergency workers search through rubble for survivors. Ahead of tomorrow's budget, the government has been setting out how it plans to reduce the NHS waiting lists in England. More than £1.5 billion will be made available for new surgical hubs and radiotherapy machines. Speaking to this programme, the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, said the NHS could not be fixed in a single budget, but the investment would help people get quicker and more accurate diagnoses.
Thanks, Fiji. It is 22 minutes to 9. In 2022, Anjak's son was found dead at his student flat. Alex had been preparing for a career as an opera singer. He had taken an anti-anxiety substance contaminated with something called nitazine. We'll get into that in just a moment. But phone records suggested he tried to buy tablets usually sold as Xanax.
Watching Alex perform and hearing him sing was, I'd say, one of the biggest joys ever in my life. I feel like half of me has gone. That will never come back. I miss him all day, every day. He was always having trouble sleeping, and this had got worse with his ADHD medication. My hunch is he probably bought them to calm himself down and try and get some sleep, I think. But that's a theory. I think there are a lot of parents out there that assume that their kids would never do anything like this. And maybe seeing Alex's profile, who he was, what he was doing in life, it just perhaps makes people think twice and think, actually, my child could be doing this.
Well,
Alex isn't the only one. The BBC can reveal that new super-strength synthetic opioid drugs linked to hundreds of deaths have been found in samples of fake medicines sold online to treat anxiety, allergies or sleeping problems. Well, I can now talk to Martin Reiter-Luber, an illicit synthetic drug expert from the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime. Martin, good morning.
Good morning.
We just heard there an extremely tragic story about someone who was trying to buy drugs online and, has ended up in this situation. First of all, what is your reaction to that? You know, some people may not know people are buying such drugs online in the first place.
Yeah, my sympathies, of course. I think it's a very tragic example that it is not safe to buy pharmaceuticals online from unauthorized sources. Of course, people suffering from anxiety and pain need help, and they should get all the help they need. But just going to the internet to places which are not authorized to sell these medications and buy them carries a very, very high risk. And there is indeed evidence that there are a lot of fake medicines out there, and some of them now contain highly potent synthetic opioids, which are highly toxic.
Why are they being put into these fake drugs? Do we know why that's happening?
Well, this is happening by drug traffickers, organized crime, essentially, which are trying to maximize their profits because these synthetic opioids, they have a very strong effect on users, not necessarily the effect they are expecting, and that's part of the danger. But these synthetic opioids, they can be obtained relatively cheaply, and it's just a way to maximize the profit of traffickers.
And who's making the synthetic drugs here, these very dangerous drugs?
We are not quite sure at the moment who's making these drugs, but we see a lot of them offered on the internet, and we have information from several countries in Europe which have come across those fake medications offered on the internet, and they're appearing to be pain medication or anxiety medication, but actually they contain a different range of substances, and it is impossible for a layperson to know if this is the genuine product or not.
And I suppose when these stories and this has been found and the BBC's reporting this today, I mean, what can happen in terms of legislation stopping this, governments making the right moves?
We are encouraging governments to consider a range of measures, and that includes, of course, raising the awareness that obtaining pharmaceuticals from unauthorized sources is not safe. So raising the awareness, but it's also an equally important to strengthen legislation, because many of these substances are new. They were not on the market. They were not even known to exist just 2 or 3 years ago. And every year there are more of them coming onto the market. So laws need to be adapted to allow the border control and allow the police to seize and destroy these drugs when they come across them. But equally, we need also more awareness and more measures with the emergency response services, because there is an antidote which can reverse the effects of an overdose with these strong opioids. It works, it's safe, and it can be part of the health response of a country.
Martin Reiter-Luber, the illicit synthetic drug expert from the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime. Thank you.
It is nearly 8:45. A new exhibition on medieval women at the British Library in London includes the story of Hildegard of Bingen, or Saint Hildegard, a 12th century Benedictine nun and polymath who fought church corruption, studied science and composed music. Our reporter Nicola Standridge has been talking to expert Margot Fassler about Hildegard and hearing a reimagining of her music by Norfolk composer Laura Cannell.
I'm walking into St Andrew's Church, Raveningham, Norfolk. Composer Laura Cannell is playing with the acoustics and history of the church here as inspiration for her mixture of early music, folk, and experimental reimagining of Hildegard of Bingen. Describe your process.
the aim of the recorder is to get as close as you can to sort of vocalizations. Look at the score and find a few notes that I think are interesting or magical. So I'll just play through the music, different verses. And I actually turned this into a piece that was... I'm imagining what's between those notes, and that's how I improvise. And I'm using Christopher Page's edition from the original manuscripts. My process is based on location, like a duet with the building, built around the same time that Hildegard was alive, composing and playing and writing music. It's absolutely the perfect loudspeaker for the recorder, speaking across centuries. I might just take four notes and loop it and loop it and loop it until I find something in there. I just think there's such beauty in such tiny detail. I love the title of that one, The Fiery Spirit, Origine Spiritus.
Hildegard's pretty easy to channel because she uses the medieval scales, the modes, in a very clear way, gives a lesson in medieval sound. She's using that gesture. It's clear.
Margot Fassler is Professor Emerita of Music and Liturgy at the University of Notre Dame in America, a leading expert on Hildegard, how she influenced popes and emperors, contributed to science, music, literature and art.
We have more securely attributed musical works by her than any other composer until the 14th century. There are nearly 80 pieces.
She wrote so much music. She had so much to say.
She also wrote nearly 400 letters. Many of them survive, and also copies of letters that people wrote to her. Hildegard was a religious reformer. She thought that the church was in dire straits.
Reforming what about the church?
It was about getting rid of abuses, such as simony, the selling of church offices.
She was allowed her say.
Because she lived in the 12th century, and this was a pretty good time for women, especially in the Rhineland. There was a major campaign to educate nuns. By the close of the 13th century, things were changing, and women were being increasingly pushed behind the walls of the convent.
She was a herbalist. She was an artist. She encouraged people to learn and to sing. She advised popes.
She was very interested in the study of science, and she knew science as it existed in her particular time and place. All of her music relates to the beginnings of time, to the ends of time, and it connects her community and the ongoing work of that community to the spinning of the planets.
So I do feel like it really surpasses religion. Is what we're doing as humans. We always are looking for this sort of magic, longing to be haunted. We long for something which we can't put our fingers on. And I feel like her music really does that.
It does. I could just leave that there. But I get to play you a bit more music at 12 minutes tonight. So have a listen to this. Don't look back in anger, because you might be. They thought they were seeing Oasis, definitely turned to maybe, and now it's a hard no. Thousands of people who bought spots sold on resale websites will have their tickets cancelled by Oasis ahead of their upcoming reunion tour. The band's promoters, Live Nation and SJM, have told our colleagues at File on 4 here at the BBC that it will cancel more than 50,000 tickets for the band's UK dates listed on secondary platforms. It said that all invalidated tickets will be made available again through the official seller Ticketmaster at face value. Well, Tom Keel, Chief Executive of UK Music, that's a trade body that represents all aspects of the UK music industry, is on the line, as is Tom Smith, former legal director at the CMA and a lawyer at Gerardine Partners. Tom Smith, I'll come to you in a moment, but Tom Keel, to come to you, is this fair?
It is. I mean, basically, there's been a lot of concern in the industry for a number of years about resale above face value. And the Oasis and the promoters were very clear before the sale that anything that was then resold on what is called a secondary site, where above face value, would potentially invalidate the ticket. So what we're seeing is enforcement of that. It's very clear that either Ticketmaster or Twickets, who are the official designated resale platform, would be the alternative means where if you needed to resell, and they do it at face value. So I would say it is fair, and I think it was quite clear in the terms and conditions, and it was quite widely promoted, albeit perhaps slightly lost in the pricing afterwards.
But you know, it's legal to do this, and so many people are caught up in this. They thought they had tickets, now they don't. I was reading about one woman who bought, you know, one at a higher price and had a plan to resell another one so that she could afford the original couple of tickets that she had got, if you see what I mean. I mean, there's different sort of aspects that of this because people have been allowed to do this. And now, you know, the upshot is they won't have tickets. Tom Smith, to bring you in on this, what do you think about whether this is fair, whether consumers are being punished?
Yeah, the fans always seem to lose out, don't they? There's an endless cat and mouse game between the secondary tickets and the regulators and the fans. Of course, if the initial ticket was sold at a much higher price, there'd be less room for a secondary ticket. Actually, the root of it is that they're selling the original tickets at below market price. The regulator made the Competition and Markets Authority made some proposals to the last government for strengthening the regulatory regime to protect consumers, but that wasn't taken forward. So and now the new government is looking at it, so I suspect something will come out.
So where do you think where do you think that will come out, Tom Smith?
Well, so the CMA's recommendations were for a new system of licensing for secondary sites, for better information for consumers, and for a ban on platforms allowing resellers to sell tickets to sell more tickets than they could legally buy. So kind of basically trying to protect fans.
Okay, so that's the proposal. It's good to hear that again, and if that especially has gone back in front of the government. Come back to you, Tom Keel. You know, people are going to be so incredibly disappointed, aren't they?
They will be, and I think search engines and also have a role to play in this too about the information. I mean, Oasis was a very popular show. It's people don't used to maybe getting tickets would also trying to get tickets in that sale. However, there are search rankings and platforms which aren't legitimately able to sell tickets coming up quite high up. So I think it's a greater responsibility around industry, but also government, but also the search engines themselves as to what they can do to make sure that consumers are aware that they are buying from a legitimate authorised seller.
And I suppose now, you know, there's an investigation we've just mentioned on File on 4. It's about this whole market out this evening on Radio 4, so people can hear more detail on that. But what's the way forward for this, Tom Keel, to you as Chief Executive of UK Music? What do you see?
Well, I think certainly we're very pleased to see that the new government is committed to looking into these issues, and certainly the Mr. Smith's comments about some of those CMA recommendations. I think another area is around speculative selling, people actually trying to sell tickets that they don't actually legally own yet. And I think that's an area which could be clamped down on in particular. Another area is around maybe capping the price about what people can actually resell out. We've seen legislation in Ireland being done and coordinated in order to achieve that. And Oasis had some gigs and dates in Ireland too, and you're not actually seeing those tickets on resale sites. So, so that you've seen that is potentially works.
Did you get any tickets yourself, Tom Keel?
Unfortunately, I didn't.
Tom Smith?
No, the machine thought I was a bot. I wasn't.
I didn't even try, despite being a diehard fan and a Mancunian. I just opted out of the whole experience. Perhaps I couldn't face being disappointed. But there we go. Many people will be in light of that news. Tom Smith, Tom Keel, thank you.
It is 5 to 9. Well, If that sounds familiar, it is because it is Chopin, or at least it's pretty certain that that's a piece of music by Chopin. The pianist Lang Lang has been recorded playing a short piece of music found within papers given to the Morgan Library in New York as a bequest and spotted by curator Robinson McLennan.
When I saw this manuscript, it was unique within this collection, and it immediately caught my eye as something that looked very much like Chopin. The handwriting, and of course it says Chopin at the top, and it's a waltz in A minor. So I had a feeling of sort of cautious excitement. In my line of work, you doubt until proven otherwise. I took a snapshot on my phone and brought it home and played through a little bit and hummed the tune and had the feeling, perhaps, you know, if this is what I think it is, I might be one of the first people in modern times to hear this melody.
Well, the story was first reported in the New York Times, and we're joined by Debbie Wiseman, conductor and composer of scores, including Wolf Hall, The Mirror and the Light, and two gospel alleluias for the coronation of the king. Debbie, welcome.
Thank you.
Does it sound like Chopin to you?
Oh, it really does sound like Chopin to me. I mean, it's not particularly tricky to play or technically complicated, but it's got all the distinctive characteristics of a Chopin waltz.
Which are?
It's got that, well, it's got a distinctive singing quality, which is very typically Chopin. The right hand's required to sing the melody. The left hand provides a very lush, rich harmonies. And probably more than any other composer, he used this sort of intimate poetic quality of the piano. And in the beginning of the piece as well, there's the strength and the drama. It gets quite loud. There's dynamic contrast, which again is more virtuoso for the pianist. But the sense of drama, the changes of dynamics, the explosive section, the elegant melody, the sudden fortissimos, all that very typically Chopin. And it's only 24 bars long, this piece. It's marked with a repeat, so it's really, really short. And I'm just wondering if it's one of these pieces, because he often used to give his friends gifts of his music. Mm. Maybe one of these waltzes was meant as a gift to one of his close friends, and he just put it to one side. And so it was never published. And of course, not every piece by a composer is always published, and this is a little exquisite, charming discovery.
Yeah. He died young, didn't he? He was only 39 when he died in 1849.
He did.
And perhaps that's why there isn't a huge canon of his work that's available.
Well, I mean, for piano, there is. He wrote around 61, I think, mazurkas, 20 waltzes. He wrote sonatas, ballads, nocturnes, etudes, scherzos. Almost everything he wrote was for the piano, because he was a master of the art of piano composition. And everything he writes for the piano grows and develops naturally. And so to be a master of one thing, to be a master of pianistic melody writing, is enough, I think, in a lifetime. And he was only, you know, as you say, very young. He had the same sort of relationship with the piano that maybe Schubert had with vocal melodies. You know, he wrote, as a pianist, he wrote beautifully for the piano. And pianists adore playing his music.
Yes, I know you've called him one of your musical inspirations. You work on a much, well, you work in all kinds of different ways and on different styles of music, but often on a big orchestral canvas, don't you, as well as voice and in quite a few different styles, including, I think, BBC TV shows you've scored the music for.
Yes.
So
yeah,
how,
absolutely.
How does he inspire you, or how has he inspired
you? Well, the idea of melody, I mean, you're right, just finished working on Wolf Hall, The Mirror and the Light, and I've got a new album called Jack Frost out as well later this month, and they are both full orchestral works. And the idea of melody taking the lead is what inspired me about Chopin. He uses melody so naturally, and he's a master of melodic invention, as well as harmonies, which are often quite chromatic, so they never go quite where you expect them to go. They surprise you. And as a composer, that's incredibly influential, because you want your music to be new and to discover new things as you're writing. And when I listen to Chopin, I never get bored of his melody writing. There's always something new. It gets